Republican State Senator Matt Murphy, longtime television producer John Davies, and the history of the 96 Bulls with Jack Silverstein. And now, here's your host, a man who fashions his game after Scottie Pippen, Justin Kaufman.
No, it was fashion my business. I just do a bunch of gin sauna commercials. And like a, what, it wasn't a Mr. Beef, it was a Mr. Sub. The Mr. Sub commercial. And he had a gun in his car. Welcome to The Download, everybody. I'm Justin Kaufman here on WGN Radio till 11 o'clock. Glad to be with you. Glad you're here. Hope everything's going well on this beautiful night here in Chicago. You could tell it's a great night. Everybody is out and about when you see just bumper-to-bumper traffic here on Michigan Avenue. And as we broadcast out of the Allstate Showcase Studio, it is just car after car after car. People trying to get to Garrett's popcorn. We got to get to Water Tower before it closes. Get to that Lego store. Big show tonight. We are going to talk about Scottie Pippen. I'm excited. Jack Silverstein's going to be here. Sort of the Download's official sports historian. Jack has put together a book, and it's very timely. The book is called How the GOAT Was Built. Greatest of all time. Not the actual GOAT. How the GOAT Was Built, Six Life Lessons from the 1996 Chicago Bulls. You know, tonight the Golden State Warriors battle the Oklahoma City Thunder in Game 5. If the Thunder continue to play the way they've been playing, this will probably be the end of the talk of the Golden State Warriors being the greatest of all time. The Chicago Bulls 96 team will continue to be the greatest, and Jack kind of breaks down how it all came about, because it's really, you know, you could say, oh, they won six championships, but that was really two different teams.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really about that second team and how it came together, how they were able to get Michael Jordan back, the moves that were made to secure Dennis Rodman and Ron Harper, and others who played huge roles in the final three championships. So we'll talk with Jack coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Coming up this hour, though, let's talk about the game, the best game in town right now, and that has to be the politics in Springfield. Senator Matt Murphy, the Republican senator from Palatine, is going to join us after the 7:30 news. We got to talk about whether or not the Senate's going to pass this bill. It's kind of a foregone conclusion, although it was interesting to see some of the senators on the Democratic side of the aisle jump out today and say they didn't like the maneuvers that the Speaker of the House, Mike Madigan, pulled last night to pass an unbalanced budget. The budget will probably get passed the Senate. That's a no-brainer. And then it's going to be vetoed by the governor. But we got to talk about what this means for compromise, for politics, for the idea of Illinois coming together, both parties reaching across the aisle like an up with people. It's not going to happen. Especially after today's robocalls from the Illinois Republican Party. We'll talk about that with Senator Matt Murphy coming up after the news. Also tonight, we talked about it with Ro just a second ago. Heroes on Deck, the story of all the planes that are at the bottom of Lake Michigan. This is really a great story about World War II in the city of Chicago. We'll talk with John Davies and his production company about the new documentary that's airing tonight on WTTW. And then again, this weekend for the Memorial Day holiday. We'll talk with John about the idea that there's still several, about 180 or something like that, planes at the bottom of Lake Michigan right now as we speak. Those are planes that crashed or sunk in the lake during Navy training and maneuvers after the bombing of Pearl Harbor to get pilots ready for the war in the Pacific. Also, my guest tonight at the big table, probably one of the most famous Chicagoans to have ever driven a taxi. Ray St. Ray. Ray is the singing cab driver. We've all had him at one point or another, and if you haven't, you know about it, or someone has told the story. We'll talk with Ray, who is actually the subject of a documentary, Ray St. Ray, which will be at the Music Box Theater this weekend. So we will talk with Ryan and Ray about the film and about Ray's career and what songs he's singing these days. I'd like to know. I wonder if he updates it. If he gets like if he downloads the new Ariana Grande and he's like, I gotta learn it. I gotta learn it. Also coming up tonight, I'm very excited about this. Swap meet. We've been talking about it for weeks now here on The Download about the idea of a Chicago Antiques Roadshow. where we essentially bring in our memorabilia and stuff and barter and trade and talk about what it's worth. I'm really excited about this. One of the guys who called in a couple weeks ago with the Greg Flam was his name. He called in with the Jane Byrne coloring book. Well, we invited him in studio tonight. He's going to be here in the 10 o'clock hour, and then we're going to have you call in to see what you have. Maybe you got better stuff than he does. Doubtful, because he sent me the list today. It's pretty amazing. 312-981-7200. You want to play? We all have it, right? We all have something that's Chicago memorabilia. You know what I have? I have the skeleton key. I have a skeleton key for the CTA trains.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I had an old family friend, this is years ago, who worked for the CTA. And he's like, hey, you, this is this key. This opens any door or any lock on the CTA. You want it? I'm like, yeah. And I've had it on my keychain for 20 years.
Wow.
Like, if you change keys, you move things around. I actually lost my keys at Midway one time through security. It was that key that helped me find them. Have you ever lost a key at an airport during security? They put it in a huge bin. And so I came back from New York, and I came back to security, and I'm like, yeah, I'm sorry. I think I left my keys here. I like went over to like a storage closet, and they pulled out the bin of all bins of just keys. And I'm like, there's no way I'm going to get it. And there it was, skeleton keys sticking up. And I grabbed it, and I'm like, that's amazing. May not have the stones to go and actually use this to open anything on the CTA, but it helped me find my keys when I lost them. So anyway, I have that. I would trade that if you got something good. You got anything good?
You would get rid of that?
I'd trade it. If you had something better, if you're like, okay, let me one up that. I got something. I got Cade McNown's left shoe.
I don't know. I've been thinking. I don't know if I have any good memorabilia.
You don't hold on to that stuff?
No. I mean, I guess, you know, like in some of the things I saw from the list, you know, there's like old paper. You know, he has some paper. You know, I have like, you know, some newspapers.
Right.
But it was more like, you know, the 9/11 covers from each paper and things like
that.
I
have to find this, but when I worked at NPR, I was working on 9/11, and I was trying to get the Illinois delegation to call in and, you know, do interviews.
Yeah.
And Henry Hyde called me on my voicemail and left a message right before he says in the voice message, he's like, well, I've got to go do this thing on the Capitol steps. If you remember, they went on the steps and they all sang God Bless America or whatever. And like before he did that, he's like, well, I got to call Justin in Chicago and, you know.
That's great.
So I recorded that because I'm like, this is awesome. It's like it's on 9/11. This is Henry Hyde from, you know, who's on the Foreign Relations Committee leaving me a voice message. So I've got that too, if you want that.
I think I'll find something good to trade all for that.
312-981-7200. News, weather, and traffic tonight with Veronica Carter and Esmeralda Leon. Of course, production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This here is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, it's Carryout. Stay with us. It's The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Now it's time for The Carryout. This, of course, is our nightly segment where I read the newspaper so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. In Springfield, all eyes on the state Senate, which is expected to pass the House's budget, which is, of course, unbalanced. Some Democrat senators, like Heather Staines, voiced their disapproval for the Madigan bill, saying we need less of this and more of this and more of that and less of this and less of everything, I think. Governor Rauner suggested he would veto the bill that would send it back to the House for 71 votes, which they only had 63 on the first vote. You can do the math. Or maybe you can't. Maybe you went to CPS. Rauner has said that several Democrats are fed up with the status quo and are on his side. He won't name names, but when pressed, he was like, Jim Anderton? Owski? It's? James? Anybody? All Democrats. So what's going to happen? Something tells me that this is essentially Madigan's way of taking his ball and going home. And Rauner's like, who needs a ball? I'm all about holograms. I'm rich. Rauner runs the Illinois Republican Party, right? Madigan, the Dems? Right. Just checking. Because that's who they both care about. Us, the voters? Nah, we're peons. We don't have any skin in this game. We don't have any shirts in this game. We're not in this game. We're the guy on the bleacher who's like, anyone tired? We'd like to play.
Think about that for a second. CPS officials organized a big rally in Springfield to protest over school funding. They bussed down. Ugh, that's a long bus ride. Wait a second. Who's paying for gas money? Was that expensed by CPS? That could have bought a textbook. Come on. Maybe I need to run CPS here. Donald Trump has hit the magic number. No, not the number of times he's lied on the campaign trail or how many times he's used a swear word or the number of long ties he owns. No, the magic number of delegates to be the GOP nominee for president. Let the balloons drop now. Yeah, bring them down. Wait. Wait a second. Are these balloons made in Mexico? Get rid of them. No, get rid of all of them. We need Trump-made balloons up in here. What does this news mean? Well, it doesn't really mean anything. He used the opportunity to just bash on Clinton for being married to Bill and for killing her friends and for the year 1993. What a terrible year. All your fault, Hillary. On the other side, Hillary Clinton was hit pretty hard by the State Department over emails. She says the practice of using private servers to email classified documents was allowed behavior shared by other Secretary of States. That's like saying that eating a few gummy worms from the candy bin is allowed behavior. Still, it's illegal. And in this case, Hillary, she was like stealing a ton of gummy worms. Make sense? And Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are going to debate for charity? What? Like Thunderlips and Rocky Balboa and Rocky III? Remember that? I think they should go one step further. I think they should do pudding wrestling, like in thongs. Give you a second to get the visual image of that. What I find unbelievable is that people are thinking this is real. And if it is real, that's even more unbelievable. I mean, seriously, what's this say about American politics? What it says to me is we're like 2 years away from Running Man. Remember? With Arnold Schwarzenegger and Richard Dawson? We're that close. Ugh. Uber and Lyft are threatening to leave Chicago over city council regulations until the GPS craps out and they just won't know where to go. In weather, all right, you know what? Enough. I'm ready for fall. In sports, we'll find out if Golden State is the GOAT or the GOAT. Game 5 in Oaktown tonight. Joakim Noah's camp is refuting the Sun-Times story that he's gone. They say they would come back for the right price, like a gazillion dollars. In hockey, they may have an arch, but they ain't got no cup. St. Louis Blues do what they do in the playoffs, and they choked. They lost to the San Jose Sharks, who right now are the best team in the Bay Area. Think about that. Hey, the Bears are in the midst of OTAs, and Kevin White is on the field. The former first-round wide receiver missed all of last year with an injury. Apparently, he was the star this week. I got an idea. You know what? Have him walk through his plays. Just don't start running till, I don't know, like early September. Also, still no Alshon Jeffrey. And I didn't know this. How did I miss this? Brian Hoyer is now the backup QB for the Bears. From the Texans, the star of Hard Knocks. Hey, there you go. I love it when I, like, skip the news for, like, one day and stuff like this happens. Love it. And finally tonight, the new Navy Pier Ferris wheel debuts tomorrow. It's bigger than the last one. So for all of you out there saying that Chicago's shrinking, hello. That's the carryout for May 26, 2016. Who here likes buffalo wings? Not the sauce, actual buffalo. They're so good and so hairy.
More to come tonight. We'll talk with Senator Matt Murphy from Palatine. We'll talk about what's happening in Springfield today, what we can expect from the rest of the spring session. Also, Ray St. Ray, the singing cab driver. Much more to come here on The Download on 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, more to come here on The Download, but first let's get a check on the news. Hi, Veronica. How are you?
Hello. Good.
Good to have you.
It's nice to be in here where it's air conditioning.
Right? Is it super hot out still?
It's still like 81.
I have been inside pretty much all day.
Me too.
I'm not gonna lie to you.
Yeah, me too.
It was one of those days. I did John Williams' Mincing Rascal podcast, but I did it at like 11 o'clock in the morning. So I've been here for a long time.
Well, we went from winter to summer, so it's probably good you're not out there because your body would not be, you know, acclimated yet.
I feel like now you got me curious. I think we should set up outside the Trib Tower right here, and we should do the broadcast live from outside. What do you think, Pete? Yeah, he likes that idea.
Yeah, he likes.
Sweat. Now you've got me. I'm intrigued. Veronica, I'm intrigued.
7:30 at night, and it's 81. And what, like a week ago, my heater kicked on in my house.
Yeah, right.
Oh, well.
All right. Well, okay. We'll talk. Well, I guess we'll keep broadcasting inside.
Yeah, probably a good idea.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, another busy day in Springfield today. The House re-voted on the budget, the unbalanced budget that was put forth by House Speaker Mike Madigan. It now goes to the Senate. Some senators on both sides of the aisle, mostly Republicans, but Democrats as well. Heather Staines suggesting she wasn't happy with the shenanigans in the House. We're going to continue that conversation because I'm interested to hear that. We should get Heather on at some point, maybe. Maybe we can tomorrow. But tonight, Senator Matt Murphy, who's a regular here on the download from Republican from Palatine, joins us. Senator Murphy, thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Justin. Good to be on with you.
So let's talk about this. I mean, obviously, it just got to you, the bill. I mean, do you guys, obviously, with the majority Democrats, this is going to pass through. What, as a Republican, what are you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking that this is a blatant failure to lead on the part of Speaker Madigan. I mean, it's a total punt. You know, we have $33 billion to spend, and you don't have the discipline to do anything other than send a $40 billion budget through. I mean, it is a complete abdication of all responsibility to the legislature. The only positive I see right now, frankly, is I actually think maybe some, and you referenced other things, maybe some Senate Democrats are prepared to stand up to Mike Madigan and shoot this thing down and tell him to go back to the drawing board.
Well, that's what they said on the other side.
I hope they do.
Yeah, that's what Governor Rauner was sort of suggesting with the House members, Democrats, and they voted in step. So, I'm interested in, for this case, obviously this budget, this unbalanced budget that's being brought to the Senate, is even bigger than last year's unbalanced budget that was brought. I mean, is this really just to put everything out there? Is this just a political ploy to say, you know what, since we're not getting anywhere with these working groups, we're going to throw everything on the table and you figure it out?
Yeah, I'm afraid it is political. The speaker talks about the governor having a personal agenda, and really a lot of this stuff is driven by the speaker's sort of personal vendetta he's got against the governor. I mean, everything that the man has been doing for the last year has been focused on trying to make sure Bruce Rauner isn't the governor after the next election. And, the people of Illinois didn't send us down here to sit here and have these sort of personal and political squabbles. He's got to engage. The Senate Democrats want to engage and find common ground with Governor Rauner. I think there are rank-and-file House Democrats do, but they need to stand up to Speaker Madigan because, look, I mean, this is exactly what you just said. A $40 billion spending plan that is $4 billion more than last year when you know you have $33 billion,
right.
That's not in any way, shape, or form about trying to be responsible or actually govern. That's about playing a blame game and trying to set the governor up to fail.
Well, Senator, let me ask you this. I mean, on the same token, talking about the Republican side, do Republican lawmakers need to stand up to the governor on the turnaround agenda, where maybe do what the Democrats have asked to put that to the side, get a working budget together, and deal with those turnaround items not on the budget's back?
Well, I think the governor has to be willing to compromise on the turnaround agenda items, and I think Republican legislators have to insist that he be willing to do that. I have been in these working groups. I have seen the governor compromise. I mean, just as an example, the governor came out, strong for right to work. And, there are super majorities in both houses of the legislature for the Democrats, and that concept is anathema to Democrats and to labor. The governor hasn't brought up the phrase right to work in month after month after month. It's not on his agenda anymore. What he really wants now is to be able to give people a property tax freeze. He wants to be able to control work comp costs to bring the cost of doing business down because, people are being killed with their property taxes, and we don't have enough good jobs in Illinois. We need to make it an easier place for people to succeed. The speaker calls that a personal agenda, but really it's about trying to save jobs in Illinois and trying to keep people from leaving. President Obama's Census Department tells us month after month that that Illinois is losing residents. People are moving out. They elected Governor Rauner in the first place to try and do things differently. Speaker Madigan has to respect the will of the people and try and work with him rather than thwart him for 4 years.
Well, I guess, this is politics at play, obviously, with a Democrat majority in the House and Senate and a Republican governor. But, I mean, at what point when you have stories that come out about the, about Illinois shrinking, people are leaving, not just the city of Chicago, but the state of Illinois, when you have stories like today that that Illinois has the highest unemployment rate in the country, at what point does Governor Rauner have to own that? I mean, being the leader, and I know that it's difficult. I know that he has people that are being obstructionist in the House and the Senate, but this is his job. He is, at the end of the day, the leader of the state of Illinois.
Well, here, look, I mean, Bruce Rauner has been around for 1 year. Mike Madigan got elected to the House the year I was born, 1970. He's been the speaker since I was in seventh grade in 1983. The governor is trying to fight for things that are going to actually turn that around. That's why he calls it the turnaround agenda. But if you go back to 2000, from 2000 to 2015, the U.S. economy produced 15 million new jobs, and Illinois lost 100,000. Now, that's all before Governor Rauner was in office. That's the foundation he came into. That's what people said we need to change and why they elected him. If we had just been average in job growth rather than one of the worst over that period of time, we'd have an extra $19 billion. That's how you grow your economy. That's how you have a stable budget process. That's how you become a better partner to social service agencies who count on the state to provide funds. It hasn't worked the way Speaker Madigan has been running it for years and years and years. And for him to just petulantly stand in the way when someone else is put in the governor's mansion to try and do it differently by the people is wrong. And the people in his caucus, other House Democrats, should stand up and tell him, negotiate in good faith. Let's do this responsibly, and let's actually put Illinois first rather than a personal vendetta you have against the governor who has come down into your sandbox and you resent it.
Talking with Republican Senator Matt Murphy from Palatine. Senator Murphy, today CPS rallied. They brought people down to Springfield, really wanted to push for adequate and equal funding. That's what they're pushing for, equal funding in schools. You've been critical that, Chicago Public Schools gets their fair share, that you've used the word bailout. I mean, the idea that, no more money be given to Chicago Public Schools until they get their finances in order. The budget does call for more money for schools. What do you say to that? I mean, because that is the one positive that Democrats will pull out, is that, it was, here we go again with an unbalanced budget, but it does address the issue that there needs to be more money for schools.
Well, the governor, signed a bill that funded schools better than they'd ever been funded last year. His proposal for this year put 100% funding level into the general school aid formula. Chicago doesn't do as well because Chicago is losing students. It ought to cost less money to teach fewer students. In addition to that, Chicago's local wealth, their property wealth went up, which means under the formula, you're in a better position to provide local resources. So, look, I think it. Everybody wants to see Chicago succeed, and education is the highest priority this governor has. But the notion that Chicago, which has been run by guys from Chicago, is getting a raw deal from Illinois when Illinois government has been run by guys from Chicago for years is just ludicrous. They have 19% of the kids, and they've been getting 36% of the state education funding. So, look, I understand Chicago is in bad shape. They need to reform their system. To just throw more money into a system that is in as bad a shape as the Chicago Public Schools is without expecting accountability is not responsible. And don't lie to us and tell us that somehow we are taking advantage of Chicago, and that's simply not the truth.
Well, it just seems to me, there's so many numbers are thrown around. Politics at play on both sides. I'm interested. My last question for you, the one thing I've noticed about Speaker Madigan is that And I've been very critical of him on this program, it seems like night after night, the idea that he seems that his constituency is the Democrats in Springfield, not the voters of the state of Illinois, the citizens. And, you know, I've really been pushing that he really doesn't want to have that tax, that sort of tax increase on his watch. He wants to put it on the Republican side of the aisle. He wants to put it on the governor so it doesn't affect his swing voters. Now, today, Governor Rauner and the Illinois Republican Party started robocalling to some of the Democratic swing district House members who voted for the budget, calling them out like it was campaign season. So maybe all this time that I've been railing on Speaker Madigan, maybe he's right. Maybe this is all about politics and it's on both sides of the aisle.
Well, look, Speaker Madigan is a brilliant political tactician. And everything he does down here is about politics. And I think one of the things Governor Rauner has learned, perhaps the hard way, is if you ignore politics, Mike Madigan will steamroll you. And the truth of the matter is the people that got robocalled on are House Democrats who should have known better than to vote for a budget that is $7 billion out of balance. Their constituents didn't want them to vote for that. Mike Madigan wanted them to vote for that. Right. They chose Mike Madigan over their constituents.
But doesn't it look bad, Senator? I mean, it looks bad right after the case that we go right into campaign mode the day after this vote is done, instead of compromising.
Kind of thing. Yeah. No, and I understand, Justin. You know, it's funny because I was on with Roe earlier today, and Roe said the governor hasn't been out front enough. He hasn't been aggressive enough in putting forth his message. And I said, you know, he dialed that back for the last year or so because he was expressly told you need to stay off the rhetoric if the speaker is ever going to come around and work with you and govern responsibly. And he tried that. He took everybody's advice. Roe referred to it today on this station as a rookie mistake on the governor's part to not stay more aggressive rhetorically. And, you know, so the governor tries to be a statesman. Mike Madigan makes him pay for it. He actually tries to defend himself, and he gets questioned for that. You know, it's a difficult situation he's in, but I think it's important that people understand what goes on down here in Springfield. And a lot of the time, frankly, I think Mike Madigan counts on the fact that a lot of people are too busy with their lives to pay as close of attention to Springfield as some of us wish they could.
That's absolutely true. Senator Matt Murphy is a Republican for Palatine. Thanks for joining us tonight. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, Justin. Thanks for having me.
Always great to hear from Senator Matt Murphy. He's great. You know, he's a really good articulate voice. I mean, obviously he's biased being on the Republican side of the aisle, but I like having him on the show.
It's great.
You know, I have a texter who says that I should call out Mike Madigan and try to get him on the show. He's been on WGN. He's never been on with us, but I mean and you know, not for lack of trying. I mean, you know, always for whatever reason, he's pretty reclusive. He likes his favorites, but I've heard him more. You know, Speaker Madigan's been on with other stations, and then we could do like those robocalls and just take it out of context. Like, it's so funny. I listened to one of the robocalls that essentially what's happening is they're sending robocalls. The Illinois Republican Party is sending robocalls to the swing district Democrats who could be affected by, you know, voters thinking that they have approved a tax increase.
Right.
And so they sent it. I think it's like seven. And these are the seven that everybody in Springfield's fighting over. And so they say, did you see what Madigan and insert person here, the Madigan, it's the Madigan slash, it's like Madigan dash Skloot or whoever it is, right? And so then they do it, but then it's so obvious. They're like, and what he said on ABC News, he's like, I don't agree with the governor, but you can hear that, like, he's going to say something else, but they just cut it
off. Like,
I think the governor is full of, you know, it's just like, come on. And you wonder if that stuff works.
Yeah, it works. Of course it works.
And it's depressing. I mean, I'm not a, you know, a Madigan guy or a Rauner guy. I'm not. I really don't. I'm trying to be as objective as possible.
Yeah.
And I really feel in this case, especially in Springfield politics, that you almost can throw Democrat and Republican out the window. Like I'm at the point now, I've lived in the state long enough and I've lived in the city long enough that I don't vote by party affiliation, and I definitely don't see these as representing the interests of a traditional liberal Democrat or conservative Republican. It just doesn't work like that. All I see is big power monger politicos who are realizing that the way that they're going to succeed in life is if they control whatever. So it's just this fight. And the idea, and that's what I was trying to get at, Senator Murphy, the idea that the day after a vote, they've got the robocall going with this sort of, did you hear? I don't know, man.
That looks bad.
It makes me feel like all of the talk about compromise and all the talk about it's all rhetoric. I mean, and I'm stupid to think it's not. But it makes me feel like, Mike Madigan may have a point. He's trying to protect his interest because he knows that the other party's coming after it, and vice versa. So that's essentially what this is. Listeners, we're watching a heavyweight fight, and unfortunately, it affects us. Like, it's not like going to the Tropicana being like, oh, it's Mike Tyson and Leonard Spinks.
Everybody gets a 30 seconds in the ring.
Yeah, this is just us going, oh, wow, this is for us? You're fighting for us? Doesn't seem like you're fighting for us. Nice gold trunks. All right, coming up, we're going to talk with Ray St. Ray, the singing cab driver, also John Davies. Talk about his new documentary, which is on WTTW, Heroes on Deck, about training, Navy training maneuvers in Lake Michigan. Also talk about the 96 Bulls and Swap Meet. I've already getting great texts in here at Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, we're going to talk with John Davies about his new documentary, Heroes on Deck, a story about planes that are at the bottom of Lake Michigan after they were used in training Navy pilots to fight in the Pacific in World War II. Also coming up at 9 o'clock, Jack Silverstein will be here, our official sports historian. We're going to talk about the greatest of all time. Yep, the 96 Chicago Bulls. The Golden State Warriors play Game 5 tonight, but already by going down 3-1. They're out. That 96 Bulls team lost, what, one game in the playoffs? You can't go down 3-1 in a playoff series, not even the finals, and be considered the greatest of all time. So we'll talk with Jack about what made that team so special and how it was built. He's got a new book out about it. All right, in studio with me now, there's a new documentary coming to the Music Box on May 30th. That's this weekend. It's called Ray St. Ray, and it's a film about the famed Chicago singing cab driver, Ray St. Ray. Ray's famous in Chicago, as anyone who's traveled by taxi at least knows of the lore of the singing cab driver. Ray St. Ray is in studio tonight, along with filmmaker Ryan Mira. Guys, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Hey there, Justin. Thanks for having us.
So let me start with you, Ray. Good to meet you. I've seen you on TV. I've had plenty of people, friends, who've been like, you're not going to believe what happened to me today. I got into a cab, and they're like, guy started singing to me. I've seen the setup. I've seen the trailers. I know, but tell us, if I'm getting into your cab right now, what is the singing cab driver?
The singing cab driver writes songs as he drives and sings them to passengers for their entertainment, hopefully some enlightenment, and his self-aggrandizing marketing purposes.
What are those? Marketing purposes.
Oh, you know, whatever project I'm working on, either a band or my solo project now.
For you, you've been driving cabs for over 25 years.
Yeah, 25 years and 12 days as of today.
Beep. Exactly. Why did you get into the business?
Originally, I decided to embark on a music career about 25 years ago on New Year's Eve. And then at the time, I was unemployed, can't play any instruments, and had never been in a band before that evening. So I figured I'd better come up with a plan. And a plan better have a day job with a company car so I can go see my kids in. So I started driving a cab and immediately started writing songs because I was bored with the stuff on the radio.
Well, I was going to say, how long did it take you for you to make the transition from just regular taxi driver to the singing cab driver?
I was almost immediate because it's what I do. And then the more I did it, the more I was like, you know, and this is the kind of song that will be, you know, my band. I was assembling a professional level band, you know, about the time that I started the cab driving, so I just started saying, you know, like, this is the kind of songs we'll be playing.
What is the usual? I mean, let's pretend I get in your cab right now. What's the setup? What do you say when someone gets in your cab, the singing cab driver's cab?
Well, if it doesn't come up in conversation, then I just mention that, well, hey, you got the singing cab driver today. Would you like to hear a song that I wrote in a taxi? And judging on their reaction, they will get such a song or not.
Okay, let's say I do. I say, okay, yeah, I'd love to hear a song.
Yeah, well, then I usually offer an option of the main topics of life that I write about, which are love, sex, social significance, or other. And then depending on what they pick, I'll sing them a song.
There you go.
Usually a cappella. Sometimes I'll have a backing track because, you know, some of the projects I'm working on, I'll have a demo in the car.
There you go. And sometimes are there passengers who are like, no thanks, not interested? Like, do you get that kind of, like, response?
They're not my target audience.
There you go. Let's bring Ryan Mira into the conversation. Ryan, you're a comedian, you're a musician, you're also a filmmaker. What was it about Ray that drew you to do this documentary?
The unique experience of the cab ride. I had him probably 10 years ago. Or probably 11 years ago, to be exact. I had just moved here and got out of work pretty late. Was pretty used to taking cabs on Saturday nights because I got out of work real late on Saturdays. Flagged him down in Old Town, got to my house, and went in and told my roommates, who were both still awake at the time, like, you're not going to believe
cab
ride I just had. This was...
I've been there,
Yeah, it was real. I mean, it's just, you're just used to telling, you know, you tell them where you're going, and then they get on their phone, and they're just talking the whole time until you get there, and then you pay them and leave. But it was just very unusual to have a cab driver interact with me immediately and just be, and then offer to sing songs, original songs, nevertheless. That was, I assumed it would be like, okay.
You know, I'm going to play what's on the radio right now.
Right. But yeah, no, it was all stuff.
Did you ever think about that, Ray? Were you like, you know, maybe I should do covers?
Never.
Never. Maybe they want covers.
No, man. You want Kanye? Go get his cab.
There's the pull quote from this interview, right?
He doesn't promote my stuff. I don't promote his. He seems to be doing okay without my help.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, Ryan, it's one thing to go home and tell your roommates, it's an amazing camera, which is a very shared, relatable story here in Chicago. You know, so many people, like I said, I've had that happen to me.
Right.
You know, what was it where you said, okay, you know what? I'm going to explore the cab driver's significance, singing cab drivers.
Well, at the time, a friend and I made a documentary about, long story short, we made a documentary about this very interesting guy who we both knew. And I just thought, like, this would definitely be a subject worth exploring. And I brought it up to my friend, and, you know, and he had heard of Ray, hadn't had him, but had heard of, you know, the singing cab driver. And it was mostly because, like, it was just interesting to me personally. It was like, it's a documentary I would want to watch, something that I would want to watch about. I'd want to see a documentary about a singing cab driver.
Yeah, absolutely.
I kind of felt that the more I kind of talked about and told coworkers about this cab experience, and the more it's other people sort of either knew, it just was like no one was excluded from the audience. Everyone either had had Ray before or had never had Ray, but had heard of him and had friends who've had Ray and knew about him, or they had no idea who Ray was and were just like, what now? You know, and we're just very intrigued by it. So there just was, you know, no one would be excluded from the audience. And so, like I said, a friend and I made another documentary about this guy, long story short, and it's like, now this would be something, another person to make.
Well, the film is Ray St. Ray, and it's at the Music Box on the 30th, which is this weekend.
It's Monday.
Memorial Day weekend
Theater.
Here. 7 o'clock at the Music Box. Ray St. Ray and Ryan Mira in studio. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back, continue the conversation about the singing cab driver. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. New documentary coming out Monday at the Music Box, 7 o'clock. It's called Ray St. Ray. It's a film about the famed Chicago singing cab driver, Ray St. Ray, and filmmaker Ryan Mira in studio with me tonight. talking about the documentary, but also about your life as a singing cab driver. I mean,
the singing cab driver,
not a singing cab driver, the singing cab driver.
There are cab drivers in this world who sing, and some who sing quite well, but none other than I can claim to be that urban legendary 21st century city and eastern son of the singing cowboy movies, the mother effing Teresa of showbiz, that white Tom Jones, Ray St. Ray, the singing cab driver. All rights reserved.
I've heard that a million times.
And you will hear it a million more.
I know.
Ryan, for you, I mean, you're collecting a lot of stories about Ray. You're also, you know, following Ray's life. But, I mean, it is a relatable story. I mean, the stories that I saw in the trailer are the same stories that, you know, I told my roommate. You know, they. So talk about the shared experience. I mean, it's usually a positive one with Ray.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. One of my favorite stories I got was someone saying that it's because it's how I felt that they were partaking in a happening of some sort, and that it felt like, what was it? He said it felt like it wasn't your normal sort of cab driver. He said it almost felt like some guy your mom sends to pick you up, and that.
I guess I could see that.
Yeah, it's a largely friendly guy, and I mean, it was
a avuncular. Is that the word you're looking for?
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah, but it was. I don't. It's just a very. If you take cabs regularly in Chicago, you're sort of like used to a certain experience, and
right.
This is
different.
Very, very, very different.
Ray, you know, one of the things I've always thought about with cabs is that you would be able to see sort of you have a certain view of the people of Chicago. And in this case, the people of Chicago, you know, you almost flip the script. They see you, you know, that like Ryan just said, it's not the atypical cab experience. I mean, they're more getting out of the cab talking about you. But for you, I mean, 25 years of driving a cab in this city, what are your observations about the people of Chicago?
Well, I love people. I love Chicago. I love to drive. So that's a triple whammy for me. Plus, you know, I've always wanted to live the life that I would want to read a book or see a movie about, and that's what the singing cab driver is. And I've driven for such a long time that it's like whole different generations of people.
Hmm.
You know, like the nightlife has changed over the years just because it's a different group of 25-year-olds going to clubs now than were 15 years ago, right?
Right.
You know, the different generations completely, you know, with different priorities and different life experiences as a common denominator. So it's like, you know, and some of the people that I, the kind of people that I was driving 25 years ago who were like 21 and 22 are now like in their 40s.
Right. But that's the thing. They all know Ray.
It's awesome.
But for you, when do you like to drive?
Well, for many years, I loved driving at night because you can drive faster, but thanks Uber, you know, business has really gone down at night, plus the change of demographic lifestyle, it seems, has changed. So I only recently in the last like 6 weeks started driving days. It's awesome. There's this really bright thing in the sky that I remember as a kid, and mostly I just wanted to see what it was like driving a cab on the other side of the planet.
For you, I mean, is there a specific area of the city that you
wherever
someone lets
might
you out
be, yeah, and take them wherever they want to go and head back to where I think people might be?
You mentioned Uber. I mean, that obviously is cutting. It's cutting into the cab industry. I mean, as a cab driver, I would assume that you have strong feelings about rideshare.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, cab drivers think of Uber rideshare drivers like wives think of whores. You know. Like, what's the difference? The wife is willing to make a commitment, and she has a vested interest in the success and longevity of the relationship, whereas the other person is just making a quick buck and doesn't care what happens to that relationship or what happens in the future.
So this is what the documentary is like, Ryan.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
I'm an entertainer, street philosopher, raconteur.
It's all true. Right, we have a couple minutes left. I would love it if you could give us a song.
All righty.
Is that possible outside the cab?
Yeah. This is a song from an album that I'm working on about the theft of our future over the last 40 years, a 17-song concept album called Future Man versus The Wrong Side of Enough. for your consideration, Wrong Side of Enough. This song, by the way, is available as a single on Amazon and iTunes and Google Play.
All right, here's Ray St. Ray, the singing cab driver.
I've been rich and I've been poor. Rich was way more fun. Poor was much too real. I wish that everyone in the world could feel somewhere in the middle. Not too much, not too little. Somewhere in the middle. Not the wrong side of enough. I've been obese and I have starved. Fat was way more jolly than sleeping in an alley and begging you for money to buy a cup of coffee or drugs to ease the pain. Trapped inside a game where everyone wants everything and someone else to blame. So I've gotten high and fallen down. High was too much fun. Down far from ideal. I wish that everyone in the world could feel somewhere in the middle. Not too much, not too little. Somewhere in the middle. Not the wrong side of enough. Slaves are fighting other slaves on reality TV. And the sponsors are so happy now, the audience believes. Illusions matter than the truth of the prices they don't see. For sacrificing character to personality. Why do they paint their mirrors and vote religiously for those who prey upon their fears, embarrassment, and greed? How can they let the men who steal the world control their needs? 'Cause the best behaved of all the slaves are the ones who think they're free. Why can't we all just be? Somewhere in the middle, not too much, not too little. Somewhere in the middle, not the wrong side of enough. I've known love and loneliness. Love is more romantic, except when it is desperate or just taken for granted. And you find yourself alone in bed with someone you don't know who thinks you should be someone else and you wish you could just go. Any place where you can love and be loved for yourself. Somewhere in the middle. Not too much, not too little. Somewhere in the middle. Not the wrong side of enough. Not the wrong side of enough. Not the wrong side of enough.
Thank you. I'll get out right here. Ray St. Ray. Chicago, the Chicago singing cab driver. You know, just a real quick question. If I do have to get out of the cab and you're in the middle of the song, I mean, do people just go, excuse, sorry, right, I'm good, right here? Like, how do they get out? I mean, because that was a good 2.5 minute song.
Yeah, well, I don't, you know, bring it up unless we get time.
Oh.
Yeah, no, I got it all.
Or you slow it down.
I'll figure it out.
He knew exactly how to get here. I mean, like, I told him, I was like, yeah, it's the cheap. He's like, oh, yeah. I was like, yeah, I think, you know, you just go east on. No, I know how to get there.
I've been on WGN before, like, years ago.
You know it.
Yeah.
Right. So is the idea at the end that this will get a better tip?
Well, I've been doing it for 25 years and in 12 days. And as I often say, I almost make up in generous tips for my singing what I fail to make due to my lack of ambition as a cab driver. Almost. Yeah. I I've been doing it so long that I know, you know, this isn't a long ride. I should sing a shorter song,
right.
Or yeah, we got time for three songs on this thing because they're into it.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And if they're not into it, then I'm not going to sing for them. I'm not, you know, I just come from my mother's funeral. Hey, you want to hear a song? And, you know, I don't do that. You know, I can read people.
Ray, you going to be doing it for years to come here in Chicago? I mean, is there a point where the singing cab driver retires?
It's not totally. You know, I really enjoy what I'm doing, and I am living the life that I would want to read a book or so movie about. That's what I wanted to do when I was a kid. I'm grown up. That's what I'm doing. You know, who can say that, right?
We do touch on that a little bit in the film.
About, and,
you know, you
what's can, the future, right?
Yeah.
But the future is, you know, as long as I can do it, I'll keep doing it. I mean, I'd love to be just working on music or, you know, sitting around a pool with a beautiful woman and working on music. Mostly working on music, but I do like the idea of the beautiful woman in the pool. But I mean, I love what I'm doing, you know, and it's like I've personally performed, you know, for an audience of at least probably 87,000, I figured the other day, an audience of 87,000 people, one person at a time.
I love it. Ray St. Ray is the singing cab driver and also the name of the documentary from Ryan Mira. It's going to be on the screen at the Music Box on Monday, May 30th at 7 o'clock. Guys, thanks so much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having us, Justin.
Pete, have you ever had the singing cab driver? Yeah. How about you, Veronica? Have you ever had the singing cab driver?
No, I did not know there was one until your show.
Whoa, see? There you go. So I knew of him, and there was a Wild Chicago that was on Channel 11 at the time that they reran over and over and over that featured him.
Was it produced by our next guest, John Davies?
It probably was. I should ask him. That's great. Yeah, so interesting. And, you know, it is true. Like, he knows the city.
Yeah.
Probably a lot of good stories.
I was I was a fan of his work. And I think we were downtown here. It was recent, like within the past, like, 5 years. I was still living up in Rogers Park, and it was down here somewhere. And he picked us up and drove us to Rogers Park, maybe 6 years, whatever.
You got one of those three songers.
Yeah, we got a three songer.
Wow.
I think it was just me, actually. But
you felt compelled. You're like, I got to get more cash.
I don't know if I tipped him based on his performance. I think it wasn't based on performance. It was typical 14.5%.
Ryan's got a thing on the documentary. I mean, you want to focus on a character, you got one. A great Chicago character. Okay, it's time for the news. Coming up, we're going to talk with John Davies about another documentary, Heroes on Deck. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, WTTW is airing a big Memorial Day special this weekend. It's a documentary that looks at Navy training operations in this area during World War II. It's called Heroes on Deck, World War II on Lake Michigan. Essentially, to prepare the Navy and sailors for a fight in the Pacific, the Navy used Lake Michigan as a training ground for dangerous water landings and maneuvers. The result is that there are several planes at the bottom of Lake Michigan. Longtime Chicago producers John Davies and Brian Callies are behind the documentary, and they join me tonight. John, Brian, good to see you.
Good to see you. Thanks for having us on your show.
Where'd this idea come from? Because this is something that a lot of Chicagoans probably who are listening to WGN Radio right now are like, I know this. But a lot probably didn't. There's a lot of planes at the bottom of Lake Michigan.
Well, it starts with Pearl Harbor. And Pearl Harbor happened, and our carriers survived Pearl Harbor. The battleships didn't. And they couldn't pull the carriers out of the war to train guys. So they came up with this idea. And they also, by the way, were worried about training them along the coastlines, the Atlantic and the Pacific, because of predatory enemy submarines.
And stuff like that, right?
So this guy named Admiral Whitehead championed this idea to put two naval aircraft carriers in the middle of Lake Michigan. Now, they couldn't get them up the St. Lawrence Seaway, so then they decided, well, let's build some. And then building became too complicated, so then they took two old side-wheel passenger steamers. These were boats that you could tour the Great Lakes on as a passenger for $59, 7 days. Great deal. And they stripped the top deck off and literally just put a flat top on. And they trained 15,000 pilots between 1942 and the end of the war. 8 takeoff and landings, and once you had successfully done that – and by the way, these planes flew out from Glenview.
Okay.
And they had to find the carriers in the middle of the lake. No easy task. And then land and take off. And once they completed that, fourth day, they were shipped to Glendale, California. And a week or two later, they were out fighting the Japanese.
It's amazing to me to think about that because, you know, I've always heard and there's some markers and if you go along Sheridan Road and things like that. But I wasn't very familiar with the story. Brian, how did you get involved in this?
Well, John and I have been working together for a number of years now, 7, 8 years, and we've done a number of documentaries. You know, Harvey Moshman, our third producer on this, John and he worked together. And then Harvey had started shooting these planes coming up beginning in 2009, and they don't pull these things up every week, every month. I mean, it takes a lot to pull these things up. And when he got enough together, contacted John and said, I think we can retell this story.
Because just truth be told, I had made this film for TTW back in 1988 under the title Top Guns of 43. because Tom Cruise's film Top Guns was on. But I had no money to make it. I had very little, very few resources, not really great footage, didn't have much of the underwater stuff. But Harvey, our partner, the other executive producer, he's a diver, a very good diver. So he talked me into remaking it. And I realized that now we could use CG. We had a real budget because we found a guy here in town. His name is Captain David Truitt, and he's the chairman of the Chicago Marine Historical Society. And he knew this story like the back of his hand, and he wrote us a check for the whole budget.
Wow.
With very few questions asked.
Yeah, that's great.
And so we finally had the resources. Anything Brian and I wanted to order, we could order. So we raided the National Archives, found some really cool stuff.
Beautiful, like 16-millimeter color footage of the actual operation on the Wolverine.
Of the planes crashing.
Yeah, planes crashing.
That's what I was going to ask. Yeah. I mean, these were maneuvers. They were training grounds. So there had to have been accidents and things that didn't go right. I mean, that's what training is. And that's why there's so many of these planes that are wrecked at the bottom of the lake.
It's the hardest thing to do. An aviator will say this. One of the hardest things to do is to land and take off from an aircraft carrier. And keep in mind, these were training carriers. These were not the full-size Essex-class carriers.
Tougher, right.
They're 800 feet long. They're 86 feet tall. These were 550 feet long and 26 feet tall. So they're closer to the waves.
Right.
It's a shorter deck. And so if they can land on these, they can land on anything. So, yes, 15,000 times 8, about 140 plus planes went into the water.
Eight landings and takeoffs.
Yeah, eight landings and takeoffs.
That's what you need to qualify.
And then out of this, guys, I mean, you know, almost as many people die in military training accidents as in actual combat. So if you think about this, 15,000 guys, 8 takeoffs and landings each, and only 8 guys perished, which it's terrible any time somebody loses their life.
Right.
But it's remarkable given the speed and volume.
8 pilots, and also there's many crewmen because they were also training too. And so there were times when guys would walk into propellers. Or there'd be some other terrible thing that happened.
Because there's no below decks on these carriers. So, guys, everything's on the deck. And sometimes these guys are, you know, come on this way. And it's deafening noise on the deck. And they'd walk into props. And a couple of other guys we heard, we don't know if this is 100% true, but we heard that a couple of guys drowned because they would sometimes swim in to, you know, party and go to the restaurants and stuff at night and have a tough time making it back.
Oh, man. It's amazing to me because, you know, there is a documented naval history with Lake Michigan and the area. I mean, obviously the Great Lakes Naval Base still is in existence on the right outside of Waukegan there. Mm-hmm. But this is something that, when you think about, is such a big part of the way that World War II played out. I mean, the idea of having this war in the Pacific and having to do everything on the water. And it doesn't seem to me to be the known story of the Navy in this area. And it seems like we would celebrate it much more than it is.
Well, here's the big deal. I mean, and Brian and I have talked about this. I mean, this would be a huge lifetime commitment. But somebody should do the documentary Chicago Goes to War, because it turns out Chicago is a pivotal player in World War II. Something like 45% of all the production of World War II took place here.
Interesting.
The whole South Side was one giant factory. Refrigerator companies became aircraft manufacturing companies.
Was that the same reason that they wanted to produce in the middle of the country so there couldn't be any surprise attacks?
It was about the work and labor force here.
Yeah.
And the materials and the trains. And this was a hub for rail and food production. And it was all kind of centered here in the Midwest. And so that's the other thing. We also discovered when we were making this film that the federal government shipped like the IRS records here and other things because they were worried about being bombed along the East Coast. So they shipped a lot of the federal offices and relocated them in Chicago.
You know, for this story, for you guys putting together this documentary, you know, what were the things that, I mean, you obviously had to go find the footage, which we talked a little bit about, but also the people that were involved in it. Is it becoming harder to find materials when it comes to something like World War II?
Well, the materials, as you can imagine, World War II has been almost exhausted in terms of stories. I mean, it has been thoroughly pored over. By the BBC for very good reasons. So when a story like this comes along that is such a major part, I mean, historians now agree that without this training exercise, we might not have won the war in the Pacific, or at very least it would have gone on a heck of a lot longer.
But
to find the guys was a hard thing, because you are absolutely right. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, we talked to a few pilots, Chuck Downey and Captain Grant Young, and they both passed away. Grant Young died before we got to finish the film. Chuck Downey saw the film. I think actually he was going on his way into a procedure and told us, I saw the film, I'm going under the knife. He survived that, but then shortly thereafter he had passed away. But yeah, these guys, we're losing them.
And these were two Midwest-based guys. We shot them here. And it's just, it's World War II generation. They're vanishing every day. But Chuck Downey was in the original film, the Top Guns of 43 movie. So I'd known Chuck for years.
Right.
And he's just a great interview. When you see the film, Chuck still got all the energy. You know, unfortunately, he was 92. And his daughter texted us as we showed this film in London a month ago at the Royal Aeronautical Society, a real trip. And I got the text at JFK from Chuck Downey's daughter that he had passed.
You know, for this, I mean, obviously it's a very Chicago story, and it's going to air here. But you mentioned, you know, London and the BBC, and they've been exhaustive in trying to tell the story of World War II. This story as you just mentioned about whether or not we would have won the war in the Pacific. This does have international hooks. I mean, this is such a big deal, and so it's not a local story. It's an international one.
Well, the other thing that makes it not local, and I hope you guys get to see it soon, is Bill Curtis. You know, it was my voice doing the scratch track. You know what scratch track is, right? And I was saying, you know what? That's not too bad. Maybe we could get away with me doing the voiceover.
Yeah, right.
And Brian's like, no, John, no.
It's a production dream, at least for me, to have a project with Bill Curtis. And when we did the voiceover, you know, he was in Chicago and we were in Los Angeles. We gets on the box and we're all, who's here? John, Brian. It's Bill, and like we just little schoolgirls, you're like, oh my God, it's Bill.
It's in my living room, coming out of the phone in my living room.
He's the perfect voice, and his voice is great. He's a respected newsman, and he grew up in Pensacola,
so
he has a real connection with this, a big Navy town. His father was in the Navy for a very long time,
and Bill was a Marine.
Yeah.
Which was part of the Navy back in World War II. And Bill and his son, many years ago, they were divers also. They went down to see one of the wrecks. You know, there's about 80-something still sitting
out there.
That's what
I was going to ask,
And we brought up about 40, not we, but this company that we've been working with. They've been bringing them up since the late 70s, I think. And they're displaying them in airports and museums all over the U.S. Like every time you go into Midway, you walk underneath a Dauntless dive bomber that was on the bottom of the lake a few years ago. Same thing when you go out to O'Hare. You pass a Hellcat, is it out there?
Wildcat
out of O'Hare, again, on the bottom of the lake.
Wow.
And so there's some in Palm Springs, in Hawaii, in Michigan, at the
Pensacola,
Kalamazoo, Arizona.
Is there a plan to bring all these 80 up? I mean, or is there a certain point where you're like, you can't get them anymore?
Here is the problem. So about 19 years ago, the Quagga Mussels came into Lake Michigan. So before this, they were pulling up planes that were pristine. These are 200-plus feet down in some cases. They had air in the tires. The batteries were taking charges. Fuel in the tanks. There was one that was restored to flying condition, a Wildcat. It flew. Anyway, 19 years ago, the Quagga Mussels come in. They start attaching themselves to all the metal structures. And now when they pull them up, they are completely encrusted. So they are falling apart. And the clock is really ticking. And the metallurgists and the experts on this say that they have probably less than 10 years before they are just mush.
Let me ask you guys as we wrap up here. As filmmakers, and you guys have done a lot of work in your careers, what did you learn from this one? I mean, what's the takeaway for you, John, for you, Brian, on Heroes on Deck?
Find an incredible funder like Captain Dave Truitt so you can really make a good film, because we're really proud of this film. We got a chance to make this film at the top of our craft, and we had all the resources we needed financially, and it's really nice when you make a documentary and you have that kind of support. But the other big takeaway is that, you know, these guys were 18 years old. They were young kids, man. They came off farms and stuff. They were driving tractors, and then, you know, 4 months later, they're fighting the Japanese, and they've got to find a carrier. And by the way, there's no computers. There's no tracking devices. This is all analog and mechanical stuff. And these planes aren't easy to fly. They have hundreds of power of horsepower. They got to get out there, find the enemy, attack the enemy, and then find their carrier again and land safely. And they're kids, you know, but they became men fast. That's why we called it Heroes. And the original title was Heroes in Training, but we couldn't clear that. So it went to Heroes on Deck, and Deck still works. But they really were heroes, these guys. And when you talk to them, they're super modest. They'd never call themselves that. This was a different generation than, you know, the me generation. They always talk team and about everybody's cooperation. But Chuck Downey was a real inspirational guy to us. I mean, we really loved Chuck. And Grant Young, you know, he sank the largest battleship in the Japanese Navy, the Yamato. He put the final fish into it. But telling us that story all these years later, he now realized there were 4,000 men that went to their death that day.
Wow.
And he's got quite a look on his face when he tells the story now. It was victory for him, but, you know, yeah, it's humanity,
it's
too.
War, right.
Yeah. So I hope you get to see it.
What about you, Brian? What's one thing that you'll never forget about this project?
Well, I think at least my approach to documentaries, I have to have a buy-in. I have to believe in it some way. And for this one, it was kind of easy. It's a love letter to Chicago. And my father was in the Navy. My grandfather was in the Navy. He actually taught the new technology radar at the time. Grandfather of mine was in the Navy. And so when you can also discover a story like this that is so big and sort of hiding in plain sight, you know that when, you know, when we say Heroes on Deck is a story of how more than 100 World War II planes ended up on the bottom of Lake Michigan, almost everyone just goes, what? Tell me
yeah,
more. You
right.
can just see them. When you know you have that one little
right
line
yeah.
and you get people hooked, you know you're onto something good. So
well, I'm hooked. Heroes on Deck, World War II on Lake Michigan. The producers, John Davies, Brian Callies, and Harvey Moshman, who's not here. Heroes on Deck, World War II on Lake Michigan, the documentary. The producers, John Davies and Brian Callies, along with Harvey Moshman. Guys, thanks for coming in. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Thanks for having us.
All right, coming up, we're going to talk about the greatest of all time, the Chicago Bulls, the 96 Bulls, Jack Silverstein, sort of our official sports historian here on The Download. He's going to join us. Also, for those listening, the Heroes on Deck is going to play tonight. I think it's Sunday and Monday, all on Channel 11. So if you're listening right now, because I had a couple people text in, you essentially can check it out tonight. Check your local listings tonight. I think Sunday and Monday for the Memorial Day weekend. Like I said, coming up, Jack Silverstein. And then coming up at 10 o'clock, swap meet. We're going to do it. We're going to do it. Finally. We've been talking about this for like 3 months. This is like Chicago Antique Roadshow. Essentially, we're going to, I'm excited. It's going to be the things that are being brought in right now from Greg Flom is a perfect way to start it. So Greg's going to come in, and he is going to bring some cool items, and we're going to essentially have you call in 312-981-7200 with your cool items and see what we got. Maybe a little trade, a little barter. I will take that Jane Byrne coloring book off your hands for a can of processed meat that I've had since World War II. That was on the top of my fridge as a joke from apartment to apartment to apartment from college days all the way through adult. It was, I forgot the name of it. I gave it to my brother, but it was like Cano meat or something like that. And it was rations and it was repackaged. And then we realized, and no one's like, no one's going to, I think my mom gave it to me like, oh, like a care package. Welcome to college. I'm like, what is this? Chip beef. So that might be worth it. I got to find it. Anyway, that's coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. Before we go to break, I just want to say happy birthday, Betty. Longtime listener to WGN. It's her birthday today. Betty, thanks so much for listening to the station, and happy birthday.
Now basketball is my favorite sport. Uh-huh. I like the way they dribble up and down the court. I keep it so fresh on the microphone. I like no interruption when the game is on. I like slam dunk to take me to the hoop.
Yeah.
My favorite play is the alley-oop. Uh-huh. I like the pick and roll. Oh. I like the give and go. Oh. And it's basketball. Bow wow. Let's go.
The title track from the new movie Space Jam, starring LeBron James. No. This is a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, 10 o'clock, we're going to do Swap Meet. It's Antiques Roadshow for Chicago. Jack Silverstein is in studio now. We'll be talking with him about his book about the 96 Bulls. But do you have a piece of memorabilia that you hang on to, that is with you at all times? That you're like, oh, this is a piece of Chicago memorabilia that I just can't get rid of.
Man, you know, my favorite piece of memorabilia growing up, actually, this is going to sound weird, but it was a Miami Dolphins wristband because my grandfather's Bears season tickets were on the visitor side, so we would go down at halftime and after the game and stand by the tunnel where, you know, players would go out, and somebody on the Fins
just threw it out.
Wristband, you know, takes it off and tosses it to it. And I was like, oh my God, a wristband. I felt kind of crummy, like sort of favoring this Dolphins wristband.
Yeah, but it's aqua.
But it
it's
came
like teal.
Off of someone.
Yeah, it's nice. Okay, so the Golden State Warriors are right now leading at halftime by 8 over the Oklahoma City Thunder in Game 5. They're down 3-1 in the Western Conference Finals, a Western Conference Finals that was somewhat predetermined because, well, the Golden State Warriors were predetermined to be the best team that ever played. If you watched SportsCenter maybe a month ago, all you saw was people on the broadcast talking about regular season records and the 96 Bulls.
It's true.
And it seemed over and over that they're like, well, I don't know if the Bulls could hold. And then Charles Barkley got involved, and everybody talked like this was a real argument. Well,
people were on some nonsense.
I don't remember the Bulls, the 96 Bulls, going down 3-1 to, I don't know, who'd they play in the, they play Orlando in the
They swept Orlando.
They swept Orlando. A team that everyone's like, oh, watch out for Shaquille O'Neal. They went, eh, get out of here.
They beat Orlando down bad.
In studio with me right now, this is an appropriate night to talk about this, a new book from Jack Silverstein, a Chicago journalist who also is our sort of, I would formalize it, our his sports historian here on the Download on WGN. The book is called How the Goat Was Built, Six Life Lessons from the 1996 Chicago Bulls. Jack, good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you too.
So yeah, let's talk about this. I mean, before we get into the book, which is fascinating, and the how you sort of came about putting together the six life lessons based on the 96 Bulls. There was a lot of talk about this Golden State Warriors team chasing and possibly eclipsing the Chicago Bulls.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll get it right out front. I love this Warriors team. This was like my de facto other team because it was actually easier. I don't have cable, but for some reason TNT lets you watch games for free on your computer. I don't know why they do that. I don't know what the business model is on that one. But, yeah, I watched a ton of Golden State games. They're so much fun. I have nothing against Golden State. People were asking me all season, do you not want them to break the record? I'm not rooting for them to break the record, but I'm not rooting against them because they're a good time.
Right.
They're a fun team to watch. But, no, I never thought that they were better than the Bulls or could defeat the Bulls. They just have size issues, as we're seeing this year.
Well, I mean, obviously the regular season records were made to be broken.
Sure.
We'll just start there. But let's talk about the book. Where'd you come up with the idea to not just sort of piece together the history of the 96 Bulls? You know, the Bulls have been well documented.
Right.
But to sort of glean life lessons from them.
It started because I was always really fascinated by the 28-month period between the 93 finals when we wrapped up against Phoenix and the 95-96 preseason when we started the road, you know, to the 72 wins. And I always thought that that period was just like a really cool, unique sports historical period where we rebuilt a championship team. We took one three-peat team and we turned it into a totally different three-peat team. Obviously, we kept the two most important players and we kept the head coach. So some people were like, it's not that different. But you're talking about 10, 11, you know, with the injured roster, 12 other guys, totally different in the span of two seasons, and to rebuild everybody and create a whole different style of play. I mean, there were plenty of similarities between the first three-peat and the second one, but there were a lot of differences as well. And that just always was... I was just always amazed by that when people would dog Jerry Krause and be like, I don't know, did you watch what he was doing?
Well, that's true because people always refer to the Bulls as winning six championships, one team, the 90s Bulls. But they were two different squads.
Two different teams.
Like you said, I mean, Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and Phil Jackson notwithstanding. But the concept that they were two different dynasties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. One thing that Jordan talked about a lot, and he talked about it at the time and he speaks about it later, is the drive that he always had to get a ring for the new guys. So in 92 there was only one new guy, Bobby Hansen. In 93, after they won the title, in his post-game interview he was like, yeah, this is for Ed Neely and Corey Williams, like, why are you talking about these guys? But Michael would find any little bit of motivation,
right.
and that was one of them. So in 96, when you had this whole new team, nobody had won a title with the Bulls. Obviously, Rodman and James Edwards, and then later in the season when they acquired John Sally, those three guys had won titles. But the main guys, you know, Harper hadn't, Kukoc, Luke Longley, Steve Kerr. I mean, these guys came from like sort of like busted teams, and all of a sudden they're on this all-time great, and it was Michael and Scotty and Phil teaching everyone how to keep the energy up, how to keep the madness up, how to go out and win the second of a back-to-back and not take a night off. I mean, one of my favorite Jordan stats is that he played from when he came back from baseball until when he retired in 98. He played every regular season game.
Wow.
He played every playoff game. He played every preseason game until the sixth preseason game of 1998, which allegedly he missed with an ingrown toenail. It came after he was the only star. Well, Kukoc was there, but Scotty and Dennis missed the trip to Paris when the Bulls went out and played in the McDonald's whatever, you know, against Europe's finest. And Jordan went out there and rocked it, so he came back ingrown toenail. Okay, fine. Sure. He missed one game in 3.5 years, a preseason game.
That's unheard of.
300, I think the number is 357 out of 358.
I mean, LeBron James comes close, but you still see him suited up for a week, you know, on the sideline. Derrick Rose, obviously, with all his troubles. I mean, even Russell Westbrook and Kevin Durant have missed extreme time. There's not an NBA star in the game right now who doesn't sit out for a week or two during a regular season.
But even look, yeah, I mean, even look at the Spurs, and that's like written into the coding of how that team works, that they know that Popovich is going to give them a night here or there, you know, like almost like in baseball,
right.
You know, we're going to give you a night off, which isn't something that happened in basketball. And it didn't happen with Jordan. And Jordan, I mean, we're talking about a guy, he turned 32 in February of 95, right before he came back. So this is 32, 33, 34, 35-year-old who's playing all those games.
We're talking with Jack Silverstein, How the GOAT Was Built, Six Life Lessons from the 1996 Chicago Bulls. Let's take a break. When we come back, let's start at the beginning with Michael Jordan and the Chicago White Sox. Really interesting stories about him and why he left basketball, playing baseball, and returning. Jack's my guest here on The Download. Stay with us.
For the three-peat, Chicago's in the house. Peace. Dribble it up, say what, Chicago Bulls. Dribble it up, what, here come the Bulls. Dribble it up, say what, Chicago Bulls. Dribble it up, yeah, here come the Bulls.
There you go. It's Download here on WGN Radio. Jack Silverstein, our our OG sports historian. He's been with us since the beginning of the show. He just wrote a book. It's called How the GOAT Was Built, Six Life Lessons from the 1996 Chicago Bulls. And in this book, it's not just, you know, just stats and hey, you remember Scottie Pippen, you remember Dennis Rodman. You really do break down, you know, what you can learn from this team, not just about basketball, but about life. Let's start at the beginning where you start, which is when Michael Jordan goes to play baseball.
Yeah.
And the one thing I find interesting is that, you know, it's still to this day is dogged by conspiracy theories and others that he was kicked out of basketball because he had a gambling problem. He was gambling on the NBA, maybe even gambling on his own games. That's never been proven. And you set out in this book at the beginning to sort of set out the ultimate conspiracy theory that all that's bull.
Yeah, my feeling is that if there were a suspension, if he were actually kicked out of the league for a year or for 18 months or whatever it was, we'd know about it by now. I just don't see that as possible. Sam Smith made a really good point on the Jordan 30 for 30 documentary, you know, that you can't keep a secret in the NBA.
Right.
If this had happened, like,
Gee, Joe Noah, Noah's not, I mean, they'd go back and it's already out.
Right.
Yeah.
That would have made your career. There was a journalist or a couple journalists who told Ron Shelton, who made that 30 for 30 Jordan Rides the Bus, that they were like, we would have won the Pulitzer. Like, we looked for everything. And I think it's really sexy and fun to think about, oh my God, he was secretly suspended. But I don't see the proof. I think in this case, it's actually probably just like the boring truth. Jordan was talking about wanting to retire as early as 91. It was documented. He was telling teammates. I mean, it's in the Jordan rules before anyone realized, what that even was going to lead to. Obviously, nobody knew.
And they thought maybe he was joking around a little bit. You know, he says, well, I'm not going to be here next year. You'll be sorry when I'm gone kind of stuff. He was doing that a lot with reporters and teammates, things like that.
And then you remember the Johnny Kilroy commercials?
Yeah, that was strange. And you point that out in the book that, you know, why would Michael Jordan, if he was on a lifetime ban or a ban for gambling or a suspension, be able to not only do it in jest, But why would there be commercial? Then, like, the NBA would let him talk about it in sort of a funny way on a commercial. You know?
Right. The guise of the Johnny Kilroy commercials was that Michael had faked his retirement, whatever that means. It's not like faking your death. You're either retired or you're not. So faked his retirement in order to play semi-pro basketball under various aliases, most prominent being Johnny Kilroy, also Motorboat Jones is another one of my favorites. And it's incredible. They got all these like NBA stars to be in the commercials talking about fake Jordan. You know, oh, he showed up in Ames, Iowa and scored 60 in 12 minutes or, you know, whatever. But he talks about in the commercials, they're not going to let, you know, Michael Jordan's not going to let anything stand in his way from doing what he wants to do. It's like teasing this idea of gambling or of being suspended.
Or suspension, right?
Yeah, exactly. Why would you do that? I mean, that would be so reckless. I just don't buy it. I think that everything is actually on the level.
Well, you know, you talk about baseball, which, and I really appreciated you breaking down the stats for the his time in the minor leagues because, you know, it's sort of the wives' tale or the main storyline is he failed. You know, that he wasn't a good player. You always say 202. You know, you see that there was the big, there was a famous Sports Illustrated Air Jordan, ERR.
Right.
But you break down the numbers and say he actually wasn't that bad of a baseball player and he was getting better.
First of all, 202, it's not like, oh gosh, he hit 202. Yeah. It's not like if Barry Bonds went out for a season.
Giancarlo Stanton's hitting 202 right about now.
I mean, Jordan hit two, let's put it the other way. Jordan hit 202. He was 31 years old. He hadn't played ball since 18. He's going to double A, okay?
Real pitchers.
These are like no clowns. Right. I mean, these are all guys. These are like kids who are trying to get into the bigs and who do get into the bigs. And he hit 202. His average was on the rise. When he went to the Arizona Fall League, he was teammates with Nomar Garciaparra the year before Nomar was called up. And Nomar was coming off a celebrated high school and college career. He was at Georgia
Tech.
Right.
He
was drafted by the Brewers out of high school. Jordan hit 252. I mean, this is no joke. Jordan was projected to be a White Sox, like, fifth outfielder by 1996.
And what happened? So, and you kind of point to the strike. And
yeah.
There was a lot of kind of posturing Michael Jordan, using Michael Jordan as a political pawn, if you will, for both labor and owners.
Right. So both sides really wanted to use Jordan. On the labor side, you've got them saying, or hypothetically saying, well, we're going to strike and Jordan's going to be with us and you're not going to get that money. And, you know, obviously on the owner side, they're going to say, go ahead. We don't care. We've got Michael Jordan. We'll fill the stands.
He'll be a replacement player.
He'll be a replacement player. Exactly. And Jordan didn't want any part of that. What I point out in the book and what I've always thought was interesting is that we've got this conspiracy theory culture, especially in the NBA. Obviously, you've got this Jordan suspension retirement stuff. You've got real things like Tim Donaghy and, you know, the official
referees,
scandals.
Right.
Then you've got things like Patrick Ewing winning the Knicks, winning the 85 lottery, all that stuff.
Bulls and Derrick Rose, but
Bulls and Derrick Rose. All right. We know that Jerry Reinsdorf was as competitive in his own way as Jordan. We know that Jerry Reinsdorf was paying Michael Jordan his basketball salary to play minor league baseball, $4 million a year. We know that Jerry Reinsdorf was the owner credited most popularly as taking the hardest line against the players. Why isn't it a conspiracy? I'm not saying this is true. Why isn't it a discussed conspiracy theory that Jerry Reinsdorf was motivated to turn the screws on the players' union to get his best asset back in the place where he was most valuable?
So you're saying that the whole Major League Baseball strike happened so Jerry Reinsdorf could get Michael Jordan back in the NBA?
I by no means would say that.
Quote, unquote. Love it. That's a good. See, we should stick on that conspiracy
theory.
That's
saying?
That's like, a much better conspiracy theory than he's out of the league for gambling. That's
I'm just saying, like, why aren't people talking about that? That seems so obvious to me.
Wow. The book is called How the Goat Was Built, Six Life Lessons from the 1996 Chicago Bulls. Let's take a break for the news. When we come back, let's go through putting this team together, this 96 team together. Because Jordan came back the year before. We all know number 45. But in that offseason between the 95 team and the 96, the 95-96 team, a lot of things happened that shifted, you know, turned this team from a, what were they, a 4 or 5 seed? Or
in 95, they were a 5 seed.
A 5 seed to the best team of all time.
A 6 seed, I'm sorry, a 6.
They were 16, yeah, right?
They were slipping. They were 3 games above 500 when Jordan came back.
There you go. So we'll talk with Jack Silverstein coming up here after the news. Stay with us. Shoot!
Chicago. That's my team, there's no doubt. I said Chicago. We got the Bulls in the house, so come on, Bulls fans. Let me hear you make noise. Get up and jump, scream, shout for our boys, Michael.
That's corny.
Picks up the pace. I said Scotty. Pippin dunks in your face, and you can bet that Dennis pulls down the boards. We got three rings.
There's a lot of passion coming out of this.
Yo, they made so many weird parody bull songs.
I know, and Pete's got them all.
Do you remember? You guys remember in '96? Somebody made. I remember it was always on the radio. Somebody made a parody of Joan Osborne's "What If One of Us?" What if God was one of us? And
was
it was Dennis Rodman is the best.
Dennis Rodman's the best.
That's what it sounded like.
Oh my gosh. In studio, Jack Silverstein. He's the author of How the Goat Was Built, Six Life Lessons from the 1996 Chicago Bulls. We're talking the best that ever was, the 96 Bulls. We're talking about Michael Jordan and his time in baseball, but he came back, he did the I'm back, that was the year before, 45-23, the whole bit.
Mm-hmm.
But then the offseason came. And what did the Bulls have at that point? They had Ron Harper. They had Luke Longley, Tony Kukoc, Scottie Pippen. They had a lot of the players that were the nucleus of the 96 team already in place.
Yeah, they had almost everybody. Remember, they traded Will Perdue for Dennis Rodman. That was a one-to-one trade.
That was the thing that they did right before the season started. They did that in the summertime where they were like,
they
okay.
did it in October.
Yeah.
They did it right before the preseason. The day that the day that Phil Jackson and Jerry Krause were meeting with Dennis Rodman at the Birdo Center, the Tribune ran an interview, a Q&A between Sam Smith and Phil Jackson, where Phil said, we're a power player away. We're one guy away from being a 60-win team.
At this point, Dennis Rodman represents the Bad Boys of Detroit. He had gone to San Antonio. He had taken on a new persona.
Right.
Like, he had left Detroit where he was just an obnoxious, just really irritating but great power forward skinny kid who had run in with the Bulls. He had thrown Scottie Pippen into the hoop. He was just a nasty guy.
Yeah.
He changed a little bit. He went down to San Antonio, changed his hairstyle. He started doing Pizza Hut commercials. He became like a folk icon.
Dennis felt underpaid, and he felt like his best skills were not marketable. Rebounding and defense and hustle and diving out of bounds for loose balls and all of those things. And even though he had had success, he'd won two rings with Detroit, he'd been defensive player of the year, he'd been an all-star, he felt like there was no way that he could earn what he considered to be a suitable salary. He wasn't going to get, quote, market value because there was no market for what he did. And so he turned himself into something that was marketable,
brand, right?
Into a brand off right. the court. And that's how ultimately he was going to get paid.
So bringing him to Chicago is obviously, in retrospect, in hindsight, a bold and tremendous move. But, I could assume at the time the Michael Jordans, the Scottie Pippins, the players who played against Dennis Rodman, who was a pretty nasty, dirty player, what was their thought? I mean, did they accept him, the idea of Dennis Rodman coming to the Bulls with open arms?
They had two thoughts, and I think that the first was, if he helps us win, let's do it. They had been dismantled under the boards by Horace Grant and Shaquille O'Neal in the playoffs against Orlando in '95, and so they knew that they had to find somebody. And the reason that they were able to get Dennis was because he had fallen so far out of favor with San Antonio.
He
took his shoes off and all that stuff with Madonna and everything. He just didn't really fit in there, and they didn't really jive with him. And they were able to trade Will Perdue straight up. I mean, just think about that. Think about that. A career backup center was traded straight up. Nobody else, no cash, no draft picks, nothing else for a Hall of Fame forward. I mean, it's unprecedented.
They just wanted him out of San Antonio.
They wanted him out of San Antonio.
It's too much of a headache trouble, which he was a headache and he was trouble. Talk about behind the scenes, Scottie Pippen, Phil Jackson. I mean, Michael Jordan, I can see being like, hey, what it takes to win, we're going to win. Talk about what was happening behind the scenes to get Dennis in the Birdo Center.
Yeah, so the Bulls, right after that 95 series, they made a list of seven power forwards that they were going to pursue. And the list, as far as I've been able to find, has not been made public. But we've got little bits and pieces of it. Phil Jackson's number one was Derek Coleman from the Nets, all-star with the Nets. Michael Jordan's number one was Jason Williams, Derek Coleman's teammate with the Nets, who Michael went to a New York nightclub in June of 95 to personally recruit Jason Williams and told him, listen, all you got to do is like rebound and maybe score some putbacks and we'll start winning rings. So he was on there. They knew they couldn't get Charles Barkley, Larry Johnson. They had tried to get Sean Kemp the year before.
By trading Pippen.
And then the Rodman thing came up. They had a head of scouting. It's called advanced scouting. When you're in the playoffs, you look at the teams who are coming up ahead, because then when you wrap your series, you might have to play them in 2 or 3 days. So you have the scout, the assistant to the general manager, and he became enamored with Rodman when he was scouting them when Rodman was on the Pistons. And so he stayed in Jerry Krause's ear. We got to get Rodman. And Krause had always said, no, he's not our – he had this phrase, not our kind of person. And Dennis Rodman was always high on that list. He's not our kind of person. OOP, our kind of person.
So behind closed doors, what did Phil Jackson have to do? I mean, there's a meeting.
Yeah.
And what did they have to do to – when they bring all of them together – with Dennis Rodman in the room.
So there was a labor stoppage that summer, and teams were not allowed to do any official business until like end of September. And because of that, Jerry Krause had a lot of time to like interview everybody who had ever known Dennis Rodman. And what he became convinced of was that Dennis was not a cultural fit in San Antonio, but that he could fit in with Phil Jackson because Phil was that weird dude. He'd written, you know, he was known even as a player. He wrote book Maverick. I mean, he was known as like this out there dude. Phil said when he came back to the NBA, like he was like, oh, I got to like cut my beard and stop showing up to interviews in hats with feathers.
And the idea that the city of Chicago is going to be much more culturally open to someone like Dennis Rodman as opposed to San Antonio.
And that you're going to come out and win. And that, you know, you're going to have Jordan to keep people in line. So Pippen and Jordan were concerned. And Jordan even went on the record and he said, you know what, he's my teammate. I love him. And like, you know, I love him in that respect. But I still have a lot of bruises. I still have scratches. And Rodman actually said the same thing. Rodman, right after he came, he said, you know, it's so weird. I like playing with Michael and Scotty, but every so often I have this instinct to just like throw him into the backboard. Like he said that on the record. So there was a certain level of tension, but everybody knew that the element that Rodman brought to that team was fundamentally different than any other power forward, any other small forward, anybody else who was going to bang with all these guys. He was a rebounding champ. He was first team all D. The Bulls had 3 of the 5 first team all defense in 96. I mean, they're winning.
You know, obviously you heard that there was tension, but the bigger tension had to be between Scottie Pippen and Dennis Rodman.
There was, and they didn't get along, but they didn't need to get along. Dennis came in, and Steve Kerr has this great quote in Roland Lazenby's biography of Michael Jordan, that Dennis was subservient to Jordan, and that he gave everybody sort of the same respect, but there was this air of Jordan's the best, and I don't want to disrupt like Jordan's, you know, this box around him, his aura or something. And Jordan and Pippen at that point had such a relationship where they were the top of this power structure that Dennis didn't mess with Scotty either.
Right.
They were all kind of, you know, there was this clear hierarchy. It was
what I remember about the team
dynamic.
Was that Dennis Rodman, at the beginning at least, it probably ended or is different towards the end, but at the beginning he kept his distance. Like he was a little bit aloof. He was a great player and he played, but he was always on a different part of the bench. He was, you know, maybe a different kind of warm up. He was a fan favorite because he changed his hair and he'd do the whole thing, but he didn't seem to be like walking side by side with Scottie Pippen and Michael Jordan when they would go back to the bench, that kind of thing.
He wasn't, and he's talked openly about that he didn't have conversations with these guys. Phil Jackson was always looking for ways to bring Dennis into the fold. He told the team at the beginning, we're getting Dennis. There's going to be different rules for him. I'm not going to freak out if he's going to be late to practice because he's going to be late to practice. We're going to handle that with fines. We're not going to talk much about it. There was one point where Phil, everyone was starting to get frustrated with Dennis around 97 and into 98. And Phil at one point pitched to Dennis, you know, maybe we'll do this activity as a team where we'll make this gauntlet. We'll give them all like rubber bats kind of, you know, like foam bats. And we'll have you run through it and everyone will get to hit you and they'll get to let out some of their frustration. And Dennis was like freaked out about it. And like really, because he was like a really shy guy. John Sally said that when they met in college at different collegiate tournaments, that Rodman would stay in his hotel room with the TV all the way up under the covers in bed, and John Sally, you know, such an affable guy, right, would say, hey, you want to come out? You want to meet these guys? We're partying, beach, whatever. Dennis would stay under. That whole thing of him coming out and him going to Crowbar and him Madonna and everything like that.
He was the anti-hero, man. Yeah. He became something that we didn't expect from this Bulls team. It was Jordan and Pippen, and it was Pippen was a bad boy in the way that he had off-the-court problems. But you really felt like he connected with a Chicago Bulls fan and made it much more culturally, I hate to say it like this, culturally cool to like the Bulls because of Dennis Rodman.
Dennis brought such another element. Do you remember this? I had all four, not that you'd remember that I had these, but I had all four of these McDonald's special cups. They were like the supersized cups, and they had a picture of Rodman. There were four different ones. And then if you put cold liquid in it, it would change the hair color. I mean,
so dumb. And then they had the gapers blocked, or the gapers delays that were on the Kennedy because they were doing the billboard with his head. He became a cultural icon here, to which I would say that not too many athletes get to that point. I mean, Michael Jordan for his skills and Scottie Pippen, but I had never seen. They were doing national reports on how Chicago fell in love with Dennis Rodman. He was a big part of what happened.
He was huge, and he showed up, and all of a sudden, the whole team changed. It was twisted on its head. There was a third person to look at and to carry the attention and to carry the media's attention, and he was also so different. I interviewed the photographer who did the photo for the billboard, for the Rodman billboard. And he's the same photographer who did the famous Jordan, Peyton, Andre Dawson in tuxedos, that thing. Yeah. And he did a ton of Jordan stuff. He said that Jordan would show up to a photo shoot about 30 minutes late, and he would demand that there would be a T-bone steak, a pound of M&Ms, and like six Gatorades. And he would like knock it all out. And then he would tell the guy, he would be like, you're a professional, right? And the photographer would say, yeah. And he'd say, I'm a professional too. And when I shoot the basketball, it goes in. I expect you to take these photos and knock them out. I'm giving you 10 shots and you get them in 10. He said Rodman was the opposite. He said Rodman showed up an hour early with two buckets of KFC and asked if he could just chill. And he had a suit coat on for the shoot. And they were shooting him, and they were going, it's not quite right. And somebody said, well, what about sleeveless? And they ripped the sleeves. That's why there's those jagged edges on that famous billboard. They just tore the sleeves off the sport coat.
So interesting. We could talk about this all night. Jack Silverstein's here, How the GOAT Was Built, Six Life Lessons from the 1996 Chicago Bulls. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. And then let's quick go through the six lessons that you learned from this team. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. Jack Silverstein's in studio with me. We're talking about his new book, How the GOAT Was Built, Six Life Lessons from the 1996 Chicago Bulls. Let's do a quick word association.
Okay,
you ready?
Yeah.
Judd Butchler.
Ears.
Okay. Bill Wennington.
Canada.
Okay. Ron Harper.
Peg leg.
Randy Brown.
Zero. His original number.
Steve Kerr.
Three.
Yeah. Okay, so that leaves who's left. I mean, I guess we do Buddha Edwards.
Tall.
John Sally.
Tall and funny.
And then the last three, I guess, are Luke Longley.
Yeah. Surfing.
Surfing. Okay, then you got Dennis Rodman.
Hair.
Scottie Pippen.
Gun. Oh, God, I can't believe I just said that. That feels so awful. Why is that the association? That I feel really bad about that. Let's go back.
Scottie Pippen.
Versatile. I think as you had mentioned earlier, that felt...
He did. He got caught with a gun in his car.
You know what, though? All right. So for my my research for this book, I read a bunch of books, and Melissa Isaacson had a great book that I had never heard of called Transition Game that she published after the 94 season. So, you know, with no hindsight. And Jordan had a gun in the locker room.
Oh, so it was
like not even reported. Like, I don't understand.
He gets caught because he probably gun in the locker room is caught by the Bulls security.
Exactly.
a police officer caught Pippen.
Pippen got caught by a police officer, absolutely. Right. But just that it wasn't discussed.
Yeah.
Michael Jordan. Gun.
All right, so you say six life lessons from the 1996 Chicago Bulls.
Yeah.
So let's go through them. So number one, you say, if your head approves, follow your heart.
Yeah. So Michael was talking about retirement as early as 91. He had always been intrigued by baseball. And I think that the ultimate difference between Jordan and Kobe, who everybody compares, is that Kobe's passion is basketball. That's his obsession. And Michael's obsession is winning.
Right.
And he needed the competition. He needed the challenge.
He's getting sick of just winning in the NBA.
And he was. He was. And he left. And as soon as he did, like, the whole time that he was gone, he was calling B.J. Armstrong. He was calling Joe Dumars and saying, hey, what's up with these new guys? What's up with this Penny? Is he good? How good is he? Like, Sprewell? What's up with him? Is Chris Webber? Like, he always wanted to know what was next. And for him, you've won three straight. You've toppled Larry, Magic, Isaiah, Charles Barkley, Clyde Drexler. Like, all of his peers he's eclipsed. So he needed to go. He needed to step away. And as we saw with Jordan's career, he stepped away again and he came back. I think that he could not maintain the fire because he was dominant. Now, maybe that's a weakness. Maybe that's a flaw in his career. Yeah. However you want to view it, you view it. But that was the truth.
All right. We got a couple minutes left here. Lesson two, don't be afraid to push your limits.
Yeah, that was Scottie Pippen. When Michael left, Scottie felt like, yes. Like he announced to nobody in the locker room in October, Michael, I love you, but I'm glad to see you go. Like, I'm not going to miss you. Like, Scottie wanted to go out there and do it. And then he had that frustration and that unfortunate, you know, incident at the end of the year with the 1.8 seconds, which his teammates all forgave him for really fast. It was really the fans and the media that didn't. Like, his teammates and his coaches.
You know, we wanted Pippen so bad to almost not be Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
In a weird way. Like, it was like we couldn't accept that Michael was gone and Pippen was even though we all were very loyal to Scottie Pippen, it just wasn't.
We didn't
Michael.
Want anyone to be right. Michael. We didn't want the next generation. We didn't want Grant Hill and Penny Hardaway to be Michael. So Scottie pushed himself, but the rest of that lesson is to be comfortable within your space and within your skills. And that's what Scottie also did.
Lesson three. Surround yourself with humble talent for a unified mission.
Yeah, that first three-peat, everybody had grown up together. So they all kind of felt like they had done it together, which they had, but that also drove more jealousy.
Okay.
And the second three-peat didn't have that. They all just wanted to win and to prove themselves.
Lesson four, think creatively about your shortcomings.
Yeah, this was the Bulls and the Warriors, the tie-in between them. The Bulls looked at their defeat to Orlando, and they wanted big guards because they'd been beaten by big guards. And so that's when they started to figure out, listen, we're going to have our small forward bring the ball up. We're going to have our shooting guard score in the post. We're going to have this flexible, malleable lineup with Kukoc at center, kind of, or Rodman kind of at center.
Rodman
took
Shaquille O'Neal on one-on-one in that series.
Right, exactly.
Lesson five, don't panic. That bad break today might be the luck you need tomorrow.
Yeah, so this is the most fun and most convoluted chapter of the book, which is how the Trailblazers signing Chris Dudley in 1993 led to the Bulls getting Bill Wennington, Ron Harper, and kind of Dennis Rodman. And it ends up in federal court, and I won't go into it now. But the Bulls lost Horace Grant in 94, and this figures into this. They considered him the first free agent that they ever wanted to re-sign and couldn't. And it was a big disaster.
That seems to still haunt them today.
And
Lesson six.
It ended up with them having Dennis Rodman.
Yeah, well, they won in that case.
Right.
Lesson six, find a coach who will help you be your best self.
Yeah, Michael Jordan was 30 minutes away from signing with the New York Knicks in 1996. His contract expired, and the Knicks put this great offer on the table, and David Falk called Jerry Reinsdorf and said, here's the deal. This is real. This is happening. Show us the money. We're out. But Michael's one concern was that he didn't know if he could play for Jeff Van Gundy or, frankly, any other coach. He said, Phil Jackson, that's my coach. I know him. I trust him. I love him. And Phil's fingerprints are all over the success of that team. He helped everybody be their best self.
Well, it's fascinating and a great appropriate topic with the Golden State Warriors playing in game five tonight. And they're winning, I believe, a commercial, but they're winning by about nine with about eight to go in the fourth quarter. They're not the GOAT.
No.
The GOAT in the Chicago Bulls, the 96 Chicago Bulls. How the GOAT was built, six life lessons from the 1996 Chicago Bulls, the author Jack Silverstein. Jack, thanks for being here, man.
Hey, thank you, Justin.
It's the download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. With you till 11 o'clock tonight. Patty Vasquez takes over. So this is exciting. I'm very excited about this. I don't know if you could tell by how giddy I've been all show. But, you know, tonight we're going to try a new segment called Swap Meet. We all own something that connects us to this great city. Whether it's memorabilia or souvenir, we go out of our way to keep it from the trash bin. When we move, we take good care to preserve it. It's not junk. It's Chicago history, right? For me, I guess see if I had it. I think I have it on me. Yeah. All right. This is my CTA skeleton key that I have on my keychain next to my car keys and all my keys. This is a key that opens up any lock on the CTA train. Nice. So back in the day, before they automated, you could put this train in and take over the microphone. Like I could do, this train goes southbound, Dan Ryan train. It was given to me by a family friend a long time ago, probably 15, 20 years ago. He worked for the CTA. He's like, here. And I've kept it on every keychain that I've had for every house, every which way, because it's pretty damn cool, right? It's pretty cool to have this. I mean, I could go on a train right now, and you know where I have used it? I've used it when I go on a train and the train is locked where they sort of have the private car up there where it's like in the middle of the train, but maybe that's the one where they drive. And it's so you can unlock that door and then shut it and be able to sit in privacy. Awesome. How about that, huh? Pretty cool. Or I still have the lanyard I have from the covering the 96 convention, Democrat convention at the United Center, or my Stein Studs Terkel book, Division Street America. What do you have? 312-981-7200. Tonight, we introduce a new segment called Swap Meet, where we invite in-studio Chicagoans with kick-ass stuff. And we ask you at home to one-up them. You can one-up them. What do you have at home that rivals what we have in studio? 312-981-7200. It's a chance to trade, barter, and brag about the things we've collected over the years. It's antique roadshows meets let's make a deal. My guest tonight in studio was a caller with a serious collection of Chicago stuff. His name is Greg Flam. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Justin.
Great to meet you in person. You texted in and you called in and you said, I got some cool stuff. And we were kind of like noodling this idea. And you do have some cool stuff. So let's talk about it. I mean, you actually, this is what you do. I mean, you're an eBay guy.
Right. For 3 years, pretty much out of necessity, just kind of got hardcore into it. And once I sold a lot of my own personal items, I started looking at garage sales and estate sales and found some interesting items. And it's better than casino gambling, finding something for $1 and selling it for like $500 or finding something for $40 and selling it for $1,200.
You've been able to do that?
Yes, I have.
You've been able to turn
and
stuff?
I brought proof tonight, some listings that I've sold.
So this is past a hobby for you. This has become sort
I'm trying. Some people think it's a hobby. I'm trying to make it a job.
Well, I mean, if you're turning stuff for $100 bucks and getting $1,200.
Yeah, I'm working hard at it. And it's a lot of fun, too, on top of it, you know. And I'm a musician by trade, so it's kind of been something to balance my life. I had 20-some-plus years, and it's, I wanted to do something else. Plus, you know, I have a semi-degree in recording engineering and stuff like that, so I wanted to just kind of see what else there was.
All right, well, why don't we start it off? Because you sent me a list of all the things that you had, and you had, like, 100 things. And it was like, I was like, this is more than I ever would bargain for. So, and it's a good thing because we can keep this segment going.
Right, it's good to have options.
So let's talk about it, Greg. Let's talk about the three things that we're going to present tonight. Sure. Why don't we start with the thing that sort of piqued my interest, which was the Jane Byrne coloring book.
Sure. Found that at an estate sale. First off, there's a big picture of Jane Byrne on the cover, so that drew me. Because that era, you know, we grew up in that era, and the 80s with Chicago Fest and Taste of Chicago, those were, like, fun times. And I was too young to really understand the politics back then, but I, you know, looking back on it now, those are some great times.
Right.
So I just threw that in my box. I literally probably paid pennies for it.
It really is.
It's not like they had it priced for $5 or anything.
It's a coloring book
right.
with Jane Byrne's face. It's not even that, like... flattering of a face. I mean,
it's animated,
a parody
cartoon,
of some sort, but it's the very unofficial Jane Byrne coloring book. So obviously it's someone poking fun at her being the mayor of Chicago.
Right.
But you have another coloring book there. We kind of put it in the coloring books.
Yeah, that one's called Circus Parade. It's not as interesting, but it does say Jane Byrne at the bottom. But what makes the Jane Byrne coloring book awesome is if you read the small print, there are coloring pages for Richie Daly, Big Jim Thompson, Jesse Jackson, Jay McMullen, and then they have who in parentheses, Mike Royko, Steve Dahl, and it's Irv Cupp's in it, Walter Jacobson.
So you could essentially color
Yeah, you could color any of these guys, and they're not colored
amazing.
In. So it's like mint condition.
That's a good one. That's a good one. Okay, so you also got a Bears package. There's a lot of Bears. Sports memorabilia is going to play a big role in this game.
Right, right. A lot of people have autographed Bears or football or baseball items. Some of the stuff I brought in was a little bit more of the rare stuff, like a Bears soap on the rope. A musical bottle opener. It plays Bear Down when you open a bottle. Body art, which is like temporary bling that you could put anywhere on your body. And then, of course, I have the Ditka's Pork Chops are number one pin and the refrigerator Perry refrigerator magnet. Mint in packaging. Where are you going to find that?
All the
Where
stuff that the Bears just kind of went, you know what, we need more tchotchkes.
Right. Right.
We should get more tchotchkes.
Never
for this team.
Enough. Never,
never enough.
Enough.
And then the third is, what do we get? The Wizzo. Tell us about Wizzo.
Now, this is really rare. Could not find this anywhere online. And as everyone knows from WGN, Wizzo, the magician, put out this magic kit. And it's complete. I did tape it so I didn't lose any of the pieces, which might not have been good to keep it mint in box.
That's all right. We're not worried about the mint.
But,
right?
Yeah, and so it's pretty nice. Got a nice picture of him on there, and it's very rare. I've had people offer me money for this and turned them down, and I'm just holding out for a certain dollar amount on that. So we'll see.
All right, so those are the three things that Greg has brought in studio tonight for Swap Meet. If you got something at home that thinks you can rival Greg, that you would say, hey, I can one-up you on this one. I got something better. Or if you felt like you could, you know, like bunch a couple things together to think that you can rival the or equal Wizzo's magic kit, let's do it. 312-981-7200. The lines are lighting up. 312-981-7200. Text or call. We'll take a break here. Swap Meet on the download. Stay with us. It's Swap Meet. I'm so excited. It's such a good start to this. People on the line, people want to talk about this. People want to compare, contrast, barter, brag about their Chicago memorabilia. In studio with me, Greg Flam. He is a collector who we found on the show, and we were talking about this. We were talking about this a couple weeks ago, and you were texting in saying, hey, I got some great stuff. So I can't thank you enough for coming in studio. Let's get to the call. So, again, before we do that, let's just say real quick, the first thing that you had was the Jane Byrne coloring books. There were two of them.
Mm-hmm.
Mint condition. They haven't been colored on.
Right.
The unofficial Jane Byrne coloring book.
Right.
The other is Bears bling of all, Bears tchotchkes of all sorts from all different times, including the refrigerator magnet.
Right.
And then the third, which is great, is Wizzo's magic tricks. Wizzo from the Bozo show. All right. Let's go to my friend Maggie. She's on the line, and she is one of the reasons why this is actually happening. Maggie, thank you so much for joining us. So, Maggie, we finally got Swap Meet off the ground, and I'm excited to have you as my first caller. You have a ton of this stuff, and I know that you feel like you can compete with what Greg's got here in studio.
Hi, Maggie.
Yeah, hi. You know, I don't have to go to garage sales. I've got my mom.
Nice.
You know, I kicked it off. I got through by talking about my Richard J. Daly funeral mask card.
Wow.
Because my dad worked the mask. My dad was a police officer.
Wow.
And so that's one of my, I got memorabilia. I mean.
Okay.
Greg, what do you think about that, Greg? Does a Richard J. Daly funeral mask card, is that something when it comes to Chicago memorabilia that's up at the top?
I would think so. If I saw it, I would definitely try to get it. I wouldn't pay much for it, but if I could throw it in a banker's box at an estate sale and bundle it all together, I definitely would grab it.
All right. Well, you know, just staying in the 70s, I also have a program from Pope John Paul II's Mass in Grant Park that I was at.
Okay. Honestly, I see those quite a bit at sales, though. A lot
do
of John
you really?
Paul II's, yeah, pins. Programs, T-shirts, even scarves. I mean, just stuff like that. Yeah.
How about a communion wafer?
Okay, what condition is it? You know, because I had someone try to show me a carrot that Bono ate and had it still in a styrofoam cup. So.
Well, it was not in anyone's mouth. We'll put it that way.
Okay, well that's a start.
Obviously, it's 30 years old.
Right.
But You know, I got a whole bin full of those No Lights and Wrigley Field buttons.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. The T-shirts. I had a T-shirt and it went for a pretty big bucks.
There you go.
Yeah. So I just had buttons, but you know, I got a lot of them, and you know, the box they're in only got stuck in one basement flood.
Okay, good. That's a good Chicago thing.
Only one, yeah.
That's a good Chicago thing.
It's better than records,
not
I guess.
That gross. Okay.
Does it? So it has the 8888 on the button, or what does it say on the button? Do you know?
It just is a yellow button, and in bright red letters, it says "No Lights in Wrigley Field."
Oh, so it was anti. Okay.
Yeah. No, it was anti.
Okay.
That's like Maggie's spirit.
Wow. You know, when you're a little kid coming home at 3 o'clock and you're dealing with what's coming out of Wrigley Field when you're a kid in the '80s, the last thing you want is walking around at night.
So, yeah, my mom worked at the company that put the steel beams for the lighting in there, so we got a lot of that stuff growing up. I'm a big Sox fan, but went to more Wrigley games because my mom would get free tickets from her company. So it's
lucky you.
Well, there you go. All right, Maggie. So I think what the takeaway here is that the daily funeral mask card is worth something, and the no lights could probably fetch you something just because that was such a big Chicago moment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, cool.
Are you interested in anything I have?
You know, my mom, you know, she just left her house of 40 years. And so I have about a third of my garage filled.
Wow. Those are my favorite sales.
So I'm not looking to add.
When I roll up on a sale like that, if it's packed, I love it. The hoarder sales, I love. If everything's priced on a table, I'm like, oh, man, this is a bummer.
Did you just call my mother a hoarder?
No, not at all. When I go to sales that are hoarder type sales.
Yeah. All right. Good. All right. Let's make that clear.
All right. Maggie, thanks so much for joining us. You're our inaugural caller, and I hope to you will be a regular feature here on Swap Meet. Thanks for calling.
I got more.
Let's save it. All right.
Thanks,
Good
Maggie.
Night.
Good night. All right. There you go. We're off and running. Let's go to Carol. Carol, welcome to the downloaded Swap Meet. Carol, what's your thought?
Well, am I on?
You're on. You're on the radio. You're on WGN.
Okay. Yep. So I have the official coloring book of Jane Byrne, plus I have a piece of State Street, the actual State Street.
Okay. How did you get a piece of State Street?
Well, my mother worked for the city, and I picked her up because they were breaking up the street when they closed off State Street and made it a bus thing.
Wow.
And I picked her up downtown and got the piece of State Street.
Hmm. Wow. Do you happen to know what part of State Street?
Right in front of the mayor's office.
Okay. That's nice.
The mayor's office is on Clark Street, though.
Well, it was
that's what I was asking, like
area.
Marshall Fields area? What area?
I don't remember where I picked her up.
Okay.
All right. 70s, I think.
Well, let me ask, Greg, like, does asphalt do anything for you? It's always hard.
This is a big piece. This is a stone, an actual big.
So, is there any plaque or is there a piece of engraved metal with it, or is it just a piece of street?
It's a piece of State Street.
Okay, that I might. Might want to pass on that one because I can't authenticate that. You know, I can't walk into.
It's a piece of State Street. What do you want from me?
Right, I can't walk into Pawn Stars and prove that that's State Street. You know, I'm sorry because I'm not trying to be rude.
No, Carol.
No, that's okay. No. I wouldn't part with it anyway.
There you go. I love it. I love it. Carol,
I see how it is.
Way to go. Thanks for the call, Carol. There you go. See, now we're on to something.
Right.
I think we're on to something because it's not traditional. Like, it's not like we're in a situation where we really, truly want to buy your thing. You know, we're not like, it's in the get-rich scheme. I love the fact that just tell us what you have. All right. 262 says, I have a signed copy of the book written by Gwendolyn Brooks, who was the first woman to receive the Pulitzer Prize. I'm not sure if that's true. Is that true? She's the first woman to win the Pulitzer Prize? She was a poet.
Out of my league on that one.
Yeah, but that wouldn't be something that you'd be interested in changing the Wizzo magic.
Yeah, probably not. As highbrow as that sounds, I might have to pass on that.
708 says, I have an old CTA coin and white brick from Comiskey Park. Got the brick before they fenced it up. They mean Comiskey Park, but both in great shape.
That's interesting because obviously I'm a Sox fan and you know, my brother-in-law has the seats from the old Comiskey, and people collect that type of thing. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. And he has it, you know, kind of in cement in a kind of a display type item. So.
That's what you really have to do with this stuff. If you're going to have a chunk of State Street, you can just pull out a piece of asphalt.
Even if you make it yourself, just print out something and put it, you know.
just put a little thing on that says State Street Mayor's Office.
Right.
Right. All right, we're on our way.
A lot of state people don't know where the mayor's office is.
Right, exactly. I think that's what it is.
Right.
Greg Flam is in studio with me. Let's take a quick break for the news. We come back, we'll continue. There's people on the line. 312-981-7200. What do you got? That's what I wanted to call this. What do you got? But swap meet works, too.
Right.
Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's 10 o'clock here on Thursday night, and we have the inaugural journey of the Swap Meet. This is our show where we take, I guess what we do is we say, you got some good Chicago memorabilia? Tell us about it.
Right.
Because Greg Flam, he's probably got better. Greg is a collector? Is that what you would call yourself?
Not really. I have no emotional attachment to stuff. I mean, I try to find something. Yeah. I mean, because I live in a condo. I don't have the room for this stuff. I don't. If it's bigger than a bread box, I usually pass on it. I can't collect old bicycles or furniture or anything like that. So I usually try to find small items. And I've gotten lucky with a lot of smaller and even paper items, posters, programs, you know, small.
Well, you have, and I don't want to give it all away because, you know, we're going to do this segment
awesome.
On the regular. So you have so much stuff.
Sure.
Tonight, the three things that you have is the unofficial Jane Byrne coloring book.
Mm-hmm.
Mint condition. You mm-hmm. also have the Bears tchotchke stuff, which is always a big part. Sports is such a big part of memorabilia.
Yeah,
and
I can move that all day. Yeah,
I mean, that stuff you're going to see all the time is sports coming through. And then you also have the Wizzo Magic Kit.
Yeah, and that's
which you got my eye on. I'm not going to lie to you.
Yeah, we might have to fight on that. I don't know.
312-981-7200 is the phone number. Let's go to Frank. Frank, you're on Swap Meet. What do you got, Frank?
I got the... George Harrison's autobiography signed by him.
Mm, awesome.
What do you think of that?
That is something that's awesome. It's not something I'm interested in per se, but it is something that would be.
Do that kind of stuff like autographed, like authors autographing books, especially famous people who may be deceased.
Of course.
Does that play big in the collector's world?
Oh, sure. Yeah. It's just not something that I'm into owning. So if I trade it, I'm going to have it for a while, or I guess I could resell it. But, I mean, anything signed usually, especially if they're deceased, is going to be a big item.
Let's go to John. John, you're on Swap Meet. What do you got, John?
I've got a autographed baseball from Nellie Fox. It's actually it's signed Nelson Fox, not Nellie, but everybody calls him Nellie.
Mm-hmm.
It's the whole White Sox team, but Nelson Fox is on it.
Okay, so the whole team is on it with Nelson Fox?
With Nelson Fox, right. Okay. I know it's better if it's just Nelson Fox.
Right, we were just talking about that off air. And, sometimes just a single signature can be worth more than a whole team. For beginners out there, it's because they had signers for some of the players, so it's not all authentic.
So, like, if they're doing a ball and the team's going to have this ball with every sign, maybe the guy's like, hey, my cousin.
Right, and I'm not doubting his item, but I'm just saying that happens a lot. But that being the age, and if, you know, you have the story from it, I'm sure it would hold up. You know, you could probably get that authenticated pretty easily.
312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're talking memorabilia. What do you got? Like I said, we're either going to call this swap meet or what do you got? All right, so let's see. 815 says, it wasn't No Lights in Wrigley. All right, that's not real. Okay, so I've got a 630. I have a Green Bay Packers mini football autographed by Jim McMahon. That's good.
Wow.
That is good.
Is good.
I will be the one, I'll be the color commentary here who says, you know what, but there's some, that's good. I understand like a football with Jim McMahon from Green Bay Packers may not actually be worth anything.
Right.
But I think it's worth something because it's when he played for the Packers.
Right, and that's hard because regionally, I don't think a lot of the Packer fans, you know, celebrate Jim McMahon with the Packers. He played there and it was at the end of his career. And in Chicago, obviously, people don't like the fact that he went there to play.
Right,
so you're kind of stuck there. but I'm sure it has value. And I don't know, if he wants to tell me what he wants to trade for, I might think about that.
Yeah, right.
I might just get it just for the funny part of it, not to, you know, because I don't think it could be worth that much.
I don't know how you're going to turn it, but it is, I do like that one.
It is different, and that's kind of what I go for.
Let's see. 773's got an illustrated booklet from the stockyards that was given to visitors taking a tour.
No, that's kind of the stuff I look for, yeah.
Very detailed with pictures of workers, animals hanging from ceiling hooks, etc.
Wow. Well, yeah, that's a little gross, but...
But
that's how it was
cool.
back then.
Yeah,
but that's how it was back then. So it's authentic, and that's how it was. I mean, I collect old stuff. I have old 50s and 60s pamphlets for Chicago here. I have a water tower place, one that's 1965. And it's funny. I have, like, maps, expressway maps from 1960. And it's just so weird how everything has changed. And that's the thing that interests me, is the backstory and,
right,
and things like that. So.
262 says, I have some pieces of the floor of Michael Jordan's indoor pool.
That... I love that. I mean, that's like, awesome.
I you know, it's on text. I don't know.
What does he,
like,
want?
Yeah.
Like, what does he want? Tell me what he wants.
It's super funny. You just have, like, these jagged, like, marble things.
Right.
Like, these, do you know what these were? Michael Jordan's indoor pool.
Right. I have that's to go
good.
With the
like
State
that.
Street asphalt again and see if he can authenticate
like
that.
630's got two connected stadium seats from the original Madhouse.
Okay.
Okay, that's interesting.
Right? Yep.
You see, I see a lot of the Chicago Stadium kind of stuff like that.
Right. And same thing with Old Comiskey.
Yeah.
Like I mentioned, my brother-in-law has the seats. And yeah, I mean.
All right. Let's go to the phones. Let's keep this going. Let's go to Pamela. Pamela, what do you got?
Yes, I have wristbands, these orange. I guess you use them if you were sweating. You put them on your wrist.
Yeah.
They're orange and stretchy.
Okay.
And it says Peyton Power on one. It's orange with Peyton Power, and the other one says Wheaties Energy.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Are they
so
used?
Walter Payton.
I mean, they're not sweaty and all, like, brown and everything.
No.
No,
okay, no,
they're
no,
new.
No.
Okay. Yeah, Walter Payton stuff is very hot right now. I mean, I always pick it up. There's Kentucky Fried Chicken Flex Record. I always pick those up when I find them.
Pamela, let me ask you a question. Do you hold on to those for any particular emotional reason, or are they just sort of jump, just kind of with you wherever you go?
No, no. My mother had them, and she kept them for a long time. And I'm at her house right now, and I'm cleaning out her house. And she loved him, and I saw these, and I was going to throw them away. And then I was listening to the station while I was cleaning up.
No, definitely don't throw them away. If anything, have a garage sale. You'll get something for them. Anything Walter Payton is good.
Pamela, that's great. Thanks.
Well,
thanks for calling.
I also have another thing.
Uh-oh.
What do you got?
Oh, it was this old, I saw Harry Carey at the park, and he had this little box. He used to get popcorn in this box, and it looked like a little, like you could shout out of.
Oh, okay.
Cardboard.
Like a megaphone, yeah. And it was a popcorn box, and then you popped out the bottom to yell out of it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he signed it. He used to be up there, and he had
that's classic. Yeah, I like that. And that's from Old Comiskey Park, right?
Yeah, and he had a... like a fishing net or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember, though, those days. He had the fishing net, Steve Stone with him. That was awesome. I'm a Sox fan, so that's awesome. I mean, that's something I buy.
That's good. All right, Pamela, there you go. You got some good stuff there.
Thank you
for calling in. That's good. Let's go to Brian. Brian, what you got?
I have some signs that used to be put up when they were doing construction around the city. I have about three of them with, you know, they have Mayor Washington's name on there.
Mm. So, okay. Like a city, that works with Harold Washington Mayor kind of thing, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
They
okay.
were metal signs. Then I also have an electrical cover that has Linkin Park on there and EWC.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, that's stuff people would buy. I can't say I'm interested in it, but I can see that selling. I've seen stuff like that sell in the past.
Why? What's the...
Because it has the person's name. If it says Chicago and Harold Washington, that makes it. I try to tell people, you know, that want to sell, like, try to cross-reference. You know, try to, you know, like, if it's a Frisbee that has Walter Payton on it and the Bears. So now you got kind of three things in one item, and that helps the value and helps it sell faster, you know. But yeah, that's be an item that might,
this is,
you know,
the
people
best
buy.
Segment ever. I can do this for 10 hours.
I love
we're
it.
Gonna do it for 10 hours.
Thanks.
Greg Flamm is in studio with me. We're talking Chicago memorabilia. the new segment called Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and we will wrap it up. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're playing Swap Meet tonight. Greg Flam's in studio with me. He's a collector. What do we call you?
Buyer, seller,
buyer,
collector.
Seller. Why don't we just call you buyer, seller? I like
yeah,
that.
That's fine.
He's a buyer, seller.
You
know, one thing, there's a lot of great calls, and we're going to get to everybody, and we're going to get to texts here, 312-981-7200. You know, for you, I mean, you spend your days going to estate sales and garage sales. Do you ever sort of contemplate that this is somebody else's stuff that, you know, we had a conversation about, you know, junk collectors and, you know, just the idea that someone might have passed on or
sure.
This stuff is moving and you're coming in and capitalizing off it? Does that ever play?
Yeah, I don't think it's such a bad thing. I think the person who passed would probably want their stuff to live on somehow and go to a good home. I'm not making a ton of money on this. I mean, I sell what I can, but there are the rare items that I can make a decent dollar on. But for the most part, I'm looking for stuff that interests me. I like the backstory. I like telling other people about the backstory. And, you know, it's fun. You meet other people. You're the old people in line at the estate sale. Oh, I remember when you could go to an estate sale and just walk right in. And now you have to get to an estate sale like 4 hours before, sign up on a sheet, get there a half an hour before, get your number.
It's a whole industry.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
and there's
weird.
A ton of estate sale companies out there, and a lot of them do a good job.
Oh, man, someday you got to take me with. I'd love to go to see one of these. All
that'd
right,
be good video.
Let's go to Gary. Gary, what you got, Gary?
Well, I don't know how to explain it. It's from 1948, and it's called the Locating the Shopping Districts in the City of Chicago. It's a retail sales guide, and it's about 20 pages. It's in a binder, and it's very big, and it has maps on every page and tells you exactly where every store in 1948.
So it's almost like a map of the retail grid of Chicago.
Right, and back then...
Exactly, 1948.
Right.
That's exactly what it is.
That's something I would definitely pick up, just to put it out there. I would pick that up. And
Is that rival the kind of stuff that we just talked about?
I'd be willing to trade some stuff. I don't know about the coloring book or Wizzo or the Bears flag, but I think I have some other stuff similar to that I would trade. He have the Chicago Tribune big snow supplement from back in the 67 blizzard?
You do. That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, no, I got it right here. You want to trade that?
No, I had that. I sold it a long time ago.
Yeah, that's a little common. I do see those.
You guys, this is negotiating. I love it.
Right.
Thanks, Gary. Thank you. Let's go to Denise. Denise.
Hi.
Denise, what you got?
Okay, I have a metal Chicago Park District sign. It has a schnauzer on it smelling a flower, and it says in bright orange letters, curb your dog.
Sure, I remember those growing up. Yep.
That's great. Why do you have that? Why do you have that?
Well, my husband of 42 years, I think he was with friends and probably acquired it when he was a teenager.
Yep. Just kept it.
Yep, I've seen I remember seeing those at parks, and that's something that definitely would sell.
Thanks.
Oh, really? Cool.
There you go.
Okay.
Thanks, Denise.
Well,
thanks for the call.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye.
All right, there you go. 847 says, I have some carnival glass from the 1893 World's Fair that was in Chicago. Wow.
Yeah, World's Fair stuff, anywhere, any of them, you know, are definitely collectible.
815 says, I have a photographer's picture of Michael Jordan when he played for the White Sox.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about that earlier in the show.
Right.
773 says, I have an old hardcover book of the Tuskegee Airmen. That had two old black and white pictures, originals, tucked in between pages. I found it in a small secondhand store in a tiny town.
Wow, those are the great stories. Because, I mean, a similar story is I found a yearbook, and there were some letters and pictures from a relationship with someone in Russia, and they were attending Illinois, University of Illinois. And that's the stuff you find.
That's the hidden gem. It may not be worth anything, but it's fun to it's almost like anthropology.
That item itself, because it's World War II, would definitely be worth something.
847, a 1963 wool Cub jersey. Nobody famous, only played a few months. Forget his name.
Okay, well, we need the name, I guess, first. And personally, because it's Cubs, no
more
I'd
Cubs.
Say no. Yeah.
262 says, they have a ticket stub from the first official night game at Wrigley Field.
Yeah, I would definitely keep that safe. You know, put it in a Ziploc bag at least, and if not that, put it in kind of a plastic enclosure. Mm-hmm. That ticket stubs do sell a lot of the Hawks stuff, especially with their success now. Any Hawks ticket stub sell, most of them you can get something for them.
815 says Cubs, CUBS, Citizens United for Baseball and Sunshine. That's the anti-Cubs
right
thing. I don't know if that they have.
I think the Pro Light or celebrating the first night game is more collectible.
Yeah, and they say, that's what they say. It wasn't no lights in Wrigley. It was CUBS. I'd pay big money for an original grassroots T-shirt.
Right. I've sold the T-shirts in the past. I get them for $1 and I'll sell them for $50. I mean, they're great. You know, they'll have the date on there, the 8-8-88 and first night game, all that. So those are great.
Hmm. 262 says, I have an Ocarina from the Chicago World's Fair. What's an Ocarina?
That stumps me.
What is
but
that?
It's
like
World's Fair.
I feel like that's from The Legend of Zelda, like it's a horn.
Wow. Okay.
That might be where I'm coming from. I'm a little younger. Let's go to Frank. Frank, what do you got, Frank?
I got a Associated Press name tag from the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago.
Wow. There you go.
That's good.
That is good. Yeah, I collect. I try to grab them anytime I see press passes or, laminates, stuff like that, I'll get. If you want to do a trade, I'd be willing to talk about that.
Oh, there you go, Frank. See? You don't want to give that up, though. I wouldn't give that up.
Right.
I've had it for a long time.
I love it.
There you go. Keep it.
Thanks, Frank. Thanks for the call. Rob's N847 says, I have a master tumbler key that would unlock every door at the Drake Hotel
wow.
before they went to electronic keys.
Wow. Old keys, old locks are great. Even like Vegas card keys, you know, with the casino
Valleys
logo.
And that kind of stuff,
yeah, especially the casinos that have been torn down, those sands and stuff like that, you know, no problem.
Greg Flam, this was a tremendous first show for
great.
Us.
It was great. It was a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
I can't thank you enough for coming out, bringing the memorabilia. I'm glad we didn't talk about all of it because we're going to have you back.
That's awesome.
But we got to do this segment on the regular. Greg Flam is a buyer, seller, collector. He goes to the estate sales. He's on eBay. And next time you come out, where are you at? I mean, is there a physical manifestation of you?
I do some of the flea markets sometimes. Once a month, I'm at the I-80 flea market in Tinley Park. A week from Saturday, I'll be at the Darien Sportsplex flea market. That's a Saturday from 9 to 1. And then for you weekday people, they start Wednesdays 4 to 7 every Wednesday till Labor Day in Darien.
Okay.
So, and it's free to get there. And it's just, there's a lot of vendors, probably 40 vendors.
Greg Flam, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Justin. It was a pleasure.
We will look forward to the next swap meet.
Awesome. Looking forward.
All right. That's going to do it for the show tonight. Great show. We're on to something with swap meet. I can thank you so much to everybody who called in and texted in. We appreciate it. And we will announce when we're going to do this again. I think we could do it at least once a month, if not more. Depends if the listeners are up for it. I think they are, based on the amazing response we got. Coming up tomorrow on the show, this is pretty cool. We have legendary trance house DJ Paul Oakenfold. Paul Oakenfold is one of the premier, if not probably the biggest DJ in house music, electronic dance music. He's going to be at the Mid on Halsted Street on Saturday night. So we're going to talk to him tomorrow about his career and about DJing and sort of the huge explosion of electronic dance music becoming pop music. So we'll talk with Paul Oakenfold tomorrow